Welcome to Movie Briefs. Today, Aaron and I start at the top of the mountain with everyone's favorite, A Few Good Men. Get ready to learn everything about military law, serving in the JAG Corps, and why Yoo-Hoo is the secret sauce to being a great trial lawyer. Stay right here for A Few Good Men. Next.
Your Honor, I object!
And why is that, Mr. Reed?
Because it's devastating to my case!
Into Harvard Law?
What, like it's hard?
By law, you're entitled. It's called disclosure, you dickhead.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
I mean, can you believe it? We're finally here. It's a thing.
We did it!
It's a thing. It's official.
We're recording it. It's happening.
It is happening. Hey guys, this is Cole and Aaron, and this is Movie Briefs. This is our first episode of Movie Briefs.
Yay!
I'm excited.
I'm excited too.
No, this is something we've been talking about for like a really long time, and we continue to tell each other, like, yeah, we should start recording that. We should do that. We should just
do it. We'll do it. We'll start recording that. We're busy people.
We're busy. It's true. We're busy, and we wanted to do it right. That's the thing.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure that's what we're doing, but...
Yeah, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, is this them doing it right? Yes, this is the best we've got.
First episode jitters. We've never done this before, yes, guys. So for those of you who know us, this is Cole from Cigarette Burns.
And Aaron from Heaving Bosoms.
And for those of you who don't, we're still the same people. You just don't know us yet. But
Right, yeah. This is...
We have separate podcasts. I have a movie podcast called Cigarette Burns, where me and my friend Jed, we break down a bunch of movies. And Aaron has...
I have Heaving Bosoms, which is a podcast with my friend Melody and I, and we go through romance novels and talk about them scene by scene.
So most importantly, though, not our podcast history, but rather the fact that in real life, we are lawyers.
We're lawyers.
And friends, by the way. This isn't the first time we've met.
We're friends. We've been friends since high school.
Yes.
Since my freshman year and Cole's senior year of high school. And since we've been friends, we've always gone to movies together. We worked at a movie theater together.
We did.
We've always talked movies together. And then we both ended up being lawyers. I don't know why.
Poor decisions.
Either of us decided to be lawyers.
Like a joint decision. It was like, I was thinking about going to law school. You were thinking about going to law school. We're like, friends, we should be lawyers. No, it was like,
no,
I guess I'll go to law school now.
I can't even say why I made that decision for myself, let alone you. So.
Right. But end result, we're here. And
we're here.
We had been talking for quite a while about like, oh, we should do a show together because we've both guested on each other's podcasts and we have a great time. And we're thinking, man, let's do a thing. And then we both decided, law, movies, this is it. This is the thing. This is what we're going to do.
Yeah, this is it.
And we also get asked, I guess I shouldn't speak for you. That's probably not the point of this podcast. But I get asked pretty commonly when people see a movie that has anything to do with law or court or crime. Hey, is this right? Like, how accurate was this? Did you like this or was it so bad for you? Do you get asked that a lot?
Yeah. Like, does this really happen in court? Can they do this? Somebody just asked me about the HBO show The Undoing. Was like, can they call these witnesses? Right. Can they say these things in court? And I'm like, I don't know. I haven't seen the show, but I feel like that's a lot, and it's a lot with this movie because I was in the Army. I was an Army JAG, so specifically with military law, I get those questions a lot.
Yeah, guys, you're probably not even going to be convinced that I'm a lawyer by the end of this because you're not going to hear me do much except say, hey, Aaron, I don't know what any of this is.
Yeah, but eventually we'll do like the Lincoln lawyer. Yep. And then I'm going to ask you questions about being a rogue criminal defense attorney.
Yep, that's where
on
I'll
the
flex.
Mean streets.
Yep, I'll shoot clients. I'll do the whole thing. It'll be great. But I guess before we dive into A Few Good Men, which, I can't wait. We've talked about this movie a million times, not really in the legal context, just it's a great movie. And we've seen it a thousand times. But obviously you mentioned you went to law school, but like, what's your legal background?
I went to law school. I graduated in 2011. I went to Tulane Law School in New Orleans. And then I joined the Army as an Army JAG, and I was active duty. I did only criminal law in the Army, both prosecution and defense. And then I got out in 2019. And now I do child protection law for the state.
Awesome.
So that's my...
background. You have been a lawyer exactly 1 year longer than me. So you,
yeah,
you are my
and
superior.
You'll never catch up. No. I will always be more experienced than you, I mean, no matter how long we live.
I'm going to tap out way quicker. I just want to be clear about that. I'm just going to be like, nah, I'm done. I'm out. So yeah, I kind of the same route, except for any of the schools and any of the careers that you did. I went to SIU for law school. And after that, I became a criminal lawyer. While I was in law school, I didn't quite know what I wanted to do, which I think is fairly common. And we have a law school episode coming up later in this season that we'll kind of get into all the stuff that movies get right and, again, get wrong about law school. So I don't want to dive too deep into it. But I clerked for a civil judge, and I had never been in court before I clerked. So, you know, I luckily had never had any issues with the law. I'd never been sued, and my parents weren't attorneys, so there was no need for me to ever be in a court. And boy, was civil law boring. I mean, holy shit. It was incredible. We did a 7-day trial about a homeowners association suing one of 10 homeowners because he had the wrong kind of bushes and was like killing bushes in his yard. And I'm like, oh my God, if this is my life. I still know what a Raphalipus bush is. Like, it's impossible to have, like, explain how terrible that trial was. Even the judge, who was a career civil attorney and then did only civil panel trials, was like, I want to declare a mistrial. This is awful. So I got that bad taste in my mouth and I left that clerkship going, I will be doing criminal law. So once I got licensed, I started my own practice, and I've been a criminal defense attorney since 2013. So I got my card at the end of 2012 and then started there in January 2013.
You know, I feel like I had the same kind of thing because I went to law school to be an environmental lawyer, and I interned for a couple nonprofit. Well, most of my law school I did, I was an intern for New Orleans Criminal Court and the DA's office down there. But I did like some environmental law, and I would like get to the organization and be like, okay, well, what are we working on, guys? Like, who are we suing? What's happening? And they'd be like, oh yeah, we've been working on this one case for 15 years and maybe we're going to get to close this ski area. And I'm like, okay.
So Joanne Galloway worked at those offices.
Yeah. She's in that.
She's an environmental lawyer now.
It's like your whole career could just be one case. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm not, this is maybe not what I wanted to do.
Although I look at that now when I look at my caseload, I'm like, maybe one case.
Yeah, maybe less than 90 cases would be a good thing.
Okay.
To have.
One case doesn't sound so bad. Yeah, it was, I kind of wanted to go the environmental route too. I think I had a great professor in law school with that. And you have these ideas of like, where can I get a job? And then you graduate and you realize it doesn't matter. I just need to get a job.
Right.
So I love criminal, to be honest with you. I think that's one of the things that keeps me very, very interested is the stakes that we get. And you get this in this movie, and I think that's why you have a lot of movies that are criminal in nature, because it's easy to make the stakes make sense to the audience, as opposed to, oh, if we win this case, this insurance company has to pay $60 million. Not saying your boy Damon and the Rainmaker didn't do a wonderful job, but
we'll do that one.
Yo, 100%. Did you know Francis Ford Coppola directed that? I think kind of like everything.
I did know that.
So, you know, that's our background. We come from mostly the criminal world. Is it usual, by the way, for JAG officers to only do criminal, or is like, how does...
No.
Okay.
JAG officers do a lot. I just happen to have the privilege of working for 7 years in criminal law. Usually that is an 18-month rotation or so. JAG officers do all kinds of stuff. They do military contracts. They do administrative work in terms of like, can we buy this thing? Can we do this thing? Can we give this award to this person sort of stuff? They do operational law, which is like, is this a war crime? Can we bomb this? Can we, you know, that sort of thing. There are lots of, and there's legal assistance too, which is kind of like the free law clinic that's free to active duty soldiers, where they come in and ask you about divorces and child custody matters and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So all kinds of opportunities in the JAG Corps.
Before we dive in, because I have so many questions about JAG, like this is literally just going to be you lecturing. You're basically recruiting me to join JAG, which is better than the Instagram requests that I keep getting.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're a lawyer right now in the U.S., you're probably getting texts from the Marines being like, do you want to do JAG, please?
Come do
JAG.
I
don't know what's going on in the Marines, but all of my friends have gotten texts from random Marine recruiters being like, do you want to be a lawyer for us? Please, please.
Every time I get one, it's weird. Just text you. I'm like, you know this guy? Is this, you guys all know each other, right?
No. I do not have the acquaintance of any Marines.
So I want to be very clear. I think we should say this on the top. This is, you know, our little liability shield. We are not in any way trying to teach you how to be lawyers, okay?
No, we're not giving you legal advice.
No legal advice. We are going to be correct jurisdictionally with what we say and what our experiences are, but this is in no way us being your lawyer.
Also, we might not be correct
And I want you to correct us. We're going to be very clear about what we know and we don't, and what we researched, and we're going to try and be as right as we can. But again...
And I know you're a one-man shop, but my opinions are not the opinions of the United States Army or the federal government or the state government or anyone I've ever worked with or been associated with. My opinions are probably stupid and wrong, but you're listening to this, so and what does that make you guys?
And here's the hard part, is you can't hire Erin. She's taken.
No, you can't. You can't. As much as you might want to after listening to these episodes.
The state has called dibs on Erin. Done.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Done.
That being said, free agent on the other side. So.
Oh, yeah. Hire Cole.
What's up, guys? Get in some trouble?
When I said that our opinions are stupid and wrong, I didn't mean Cole's a great lawyer. He's a great lawyer. You should hire him.
Especially get in some trouble either in federal courts or California. That would be much easier for me to represent you.
Is that what this is? Am I on a, like, are you injured for the Cole Law Firm?
I incepted you over the last 6 months, and this is just a long infomercial for...
I didn't know.
Law Office of Cole Williams, found at williamsdefense.com.
Gosh, I hope this gets you some business.
But anyway, guys, this obviously isn't going to be a super serious podcast. I don't think that we have it in us to do a serious podcast.
I don't.
I don't want to know that person. I don't want to know those people. It's hard enough for me to get through a trial and be serious the entire time, so it's definitely not going to be this. So sit back, relax. You don't need to take notes. It's all good. We're gonna have some fun. I think we got to jump into A Few Good Men. We got to get into this thing.
Yeah. Let's transport ourselves back to 1992.
Young Aaron Sorkin, pre-crack cocaine, has decided to write himself a play.
I don't know that you can make that assertion, but pre-dependence on crack cocaine, I think we can say.
Pre-public knowledge of crack cocaine for Aaron Sorkin. He sits down and he writes himself a play called A Few Good Men. And Rob Reiner and Castle Rock are like, we're going to buy that. And we're going to make that into a movie. And they did. And it's freaking awesome.
Well, and Sorkin wrote this screenplay because apparently his sister was a defense counsel. I don't know if she was an active duty JAG or a civilian defense counsel, because you can hire your own civilian defense counsel if you're in the military system. You don't have to go with Tom Cruise, who's appointed for you. So I don't know if she was in the military or not, but she was a defense counsel on a very similar case, which this movie was based on. You can Google it. One of the accused in the case was a man named David Cox, who was acquitted and then promptly shot to death not long after, probably for retribution from this trial. It's a very interesting case.
I'll have to look at that. I honestly only focused on the movie. I remember you had told me, like, hey, this was based on a real case. And I was like, oh, God, that feels like a rabbit hole I could go down and never come out of. So post-recording this, I feel like I'm going to jump into that.
Yeah, it's interesting.
You mentioned civilian lawyers coming into military court. How's that usually go?
It's usually people who have been, like, somebody like me who was in and got out and now wants to make money. But sometimes you get someone who just wanders into military court that does not know what's going on. And that's always a fun time, just to, like, watch and, like, marvel in the fact that they're getting paid like 15 times more than you are for wearing a uniform. But anytime there's a civilian lawyer on a case, there's also an appointed military counsel on a case, so that just to make sure that everybody's got competent counsel and knows the rules. But sometimes that can be a little bit of a circus.
Do they operate as co-counsel then, or is it just second chair automatically?
And you are, like, sometimes a civilian attorney will come on a case and be like, you're going to do everything. You're going to do all the cross-examinations. You're going to open and you're going to close, and I'm just going to sit there. And, you know, that's up to them and their client why they're getting paid for that. And then other times they come onto the case and they say, you're going to sit there like a potted plant. This is my show. So you just kind of take their lead and do whatever they want you to do on the case.
That sounds like something I should look into. We'll talk later. Because even in regular state court, county to county gets so different. So when I've had cases, I mean, I do primarily in the southern, like, seven counties of California, but I've had cases that are up by San Francisco, in Monterey. And I remember going to Monterey County and I was talking to the district attorney, and it's not that you get confused about, like, what the California rules of court are, but everyone has local rules. Right. And then even if you don't have a local rule that's been printed, every judge wants something slightly differently, or they mm-hmm. have different forms county to county. Even here, LA and Riverside and Orange County, they all their tall forms, which are the plea forms that you sign if you make a deal, they're all different. I mean, it makes no sense to me why they're different, but they are. So the idea of just going county to county can be sometimes intimidating if you've never been there, and you get hometowned all the time. But the idea of just, like, walking into a court where the Uniform Code of Military Justice is now the operative law and you have no idea how any of this goes would be like good for the people who want to try and dip that toe, but I feel like unless you have that JAG background, that can go really bad really fast.
I've seen it go really bad really fast, and it's really funny. I'd like to see that movie, but unfortunately everybody in this case is in the military, even though they're mostly bad at being lawyers. Okay. All right. Yes. So we start off in, like, a Marines, like, parade where they're flipping around all their guns and stuff. Love and it. We're supposed to be really, like, impressed by the precision of the Marines and the dedication of the Marines and, like, wow, Marines.
That's what they need to be texting me, by the way. These are the videos I need to be getting from the JAG recruiters.
Yeah, you want to flip this gun around?
You want to see this every day when you go to work?
Yeah. And then we're thoroughly impressed. We have been impressed. And then Joe, Lieutenant Commander Joe Galloway, just fucking strolls through the grass, on the grass, which is like, you never walk on the grass in the military. Like, you have to be, like, really, really fundamentally really bad at being in the military to walk on grass in front of this formation, just strolling across in her dress uniform, just like, blip, 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 I'm walking across the parade field. She would have gotten, I mean, just nailed to a wall for that. But, you know, whatever. She's a bad Marine and a bad sailor.
Bad sailor.
And a bad lawyer.
I mean,
she's a Navy.
Maybe the least egregious mistake she makes this entire movie.
Fair enough. But the one that she would get screamed at for the loudest, for sure.
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, compared to some of the legal mistakes she makes in this movie, she could have been doing a slip and slide through that yard, and I'd still be like, yeah, we'll give her the pass on that because we got to focus on this other shit.
Fair enough.
Before we dive too deep, I want the quick and dirty. I know, obviously, you were in JAG, but how did you join it? Did they come to your law school?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, so when you're in law school, you can, at least this was my experience, I assume it's everybody's experience, there's, like, a firm will come and be like, we're interviewing, you know.
Right.
Williams & Williams is coming to interview at the law school. And then you go on to your little, like, interviewee thing, and then you click the boxes of the firms you would like to interview with. And then they come back and, you know, you send them your resume and everything. And then they come back and be like, okay, we'll interview you. And if your law school is like mine, it's the same 20 people getting interviewed for every firm, no matter who's clicking. Because everybody just wants to interview the top 25%, or at least they did in the Great Recession of the late aughts.
Right.
So I checked every box all the time and didn't even look to see what firm or agency was interviewing. And the only one that came back on this, like, interview season for me was the Army. And I was like, the Army? I guess I'll do an interview. It's good interview practice, even if, like, that's not. But then I did some research, it was a really good gig, and I did the interview and it went well, and I went through the other 15 steps of application process, and I made it. Some people come into the JAG Corps because they were previously enlisted members of the military or officers, and they can apply for a program where the military pays for you to go to law school, and actually pays you a salary while you're in law school.
That would have been better. I would have liked getting paid while I was in law school.
That would have been, much, much better. And then they allow you to come back in and then be a JAG. It's a really competitive program. And then some people come in the way I came in, through direct commission, and go to basic training and go to military law school for a few months and then come in.
And so the military law school, and I remember you telling me at some point that was like 5 or 6 months or something.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. And the basic training phase was like 6 weeks, and then the law school phase with a few months.
Okay. So that's obviously where they like introduce you to the UCMJ.
Yep. Yeah. And everything else too. Okay. The fiscal law, the operational law, the Geneva War Convention sort of stuff. And, okay. You know, all that's in there.
And the thing that always shocked me, because you and I would, you know, we talk about cases all the time. We talk about shit at work all the time. But you would describe for me stuff that's a crime in the UCMJ that is just not just not a crime in civilian life, just not even close to being a crime.
No. Yeah. Like malingering, which would be like you faked sick or fell out, like didn't run fast enough because you didn't try hard enough.
That's not what that sounds like, by the way.
No. There are a few, you know, like a crime in this is conduct on becoming a Marine, which is not a real crime because it's conduct on becoming an officer and a gentleman. But just like stuff you can do that like reflects badly on the military, that they're like, well, we didn't think to write that down, Private Williams, in the code, but like you really embarrassed the military today. And here you go. Here's your, you know, criminal conviction.
Yeah, it's funny because there's a lot of times in my job I have to tell people who like come in, because sometimes I do victim work, and they'll come in and ask for either, do you think we can get a restraining order, or you think we can get this, or should I press charges or whatever? And it's a lot of times, sadly, it's like, no, that guy sounds like an asshole and he was doing something out in public that was stupid, but being stupid, not a crime. Sorry, it's just not.
Being stupid is often a crime and in the military.
That was a big difference.
Dueling used to be a crime right up until the 2016 changes to the UCMJ.
So dueling is no sodomy. Longer a crime?
Dueling is no longer a crime. That's just going to be an old-fashioned assault, I think. Just be the other crimes that are inherent in dueling.
Because I was going to say, by the way, just out here, dueling, still a crime. Don't go duel.
Yeah. No, don't duel. But if I just slap your face with my glove and demand satisfaction, that is not in itself a crime except for the assault of the slapping of the glove.
That's awesome. Sorry. And I don't think there are, but you guys, is there modified rules of evidence and like different standards of proof in criminal court versus civilian criminal court?
No.
Or is it all kind of straightforward?
It's almost identical to the federal rules of evidence. It's very, very similar.
Okay, cool. That was my little JAG background that I've had questions about that we've talked about, but I always forget them. And like, I'll be talking to Jess. She's like, so what about this in JAG? I'm like, I know Max told me that, but I don't remember. I try to listen.
Now you can listen back to the recording.
Yeah, now I've just got
all
it.
Right. Back to this parade field, back to the grass.
Please, yes, get us back to the grass. Thank you.
Sorry, no, do you have more background you want to go through? I was really excited to talk about that.
No. So, okay, let's get back to Joanne Galloway and bringing this case she's an internal affairs attorney.
Yes.
For the Navy, and she's taking this to her apparently superiors to request assignment to the case. Am I getting that right? So
it's like she's not even requesting that she did request that she be assigned to the case,
yes,
and they declined
that it be I or her that then gets potentially, maybe if you don't mind, sir, assigned to the case, or however very eloquently she said it.
Right.
So is this how you guys get cases? Is this how this works?
No, it's like so weird because she marches in there and she's like, hey, gentlemen, I've heard of that there was this murder down in Cuba, like through the grapevine. Somehow somebody has told me that there was a murder in Cuba, which is like, okay, it's a Tuesday in the Marines. Like, I don't understand like how this particular one was that like big. It's not like everybody's murdering each other, but it's like any criminal jurisdiction. It's like a random murder is not like, oh my God, all hands on deck, a murder, you know, it's
right.
Fairly normal. So she's heard of a murder. And she would like somebody, you know what I mean? It really
She's
seems like it should be more
murder.
Special. Yeah. And she wants counsel to be appointed, which is like, in the military, counsel is appointed automatically. And it's appointed out of the jurisdiction where the thing happened. So automatically, somebody stationed at Gitmo would get this appointment. Both the prosecutor and the defense attorney would land on their desk, you know, that day. Or, you know, these guys, it would be the day that they wandered into the defense counsel's office after committing or not committing or being suspected of the crime, or the day that they landed in pretrial confinement for that crime. This would land on a TDS attorney's office, a defense attorney's office. So I don't know, Like it's not like the civilian world where you have to meet a certain like poverty threshold to be appointed an attorney. Then she asks that she be appointed, which is very weird because she's not even a criminal defense attorney. She's an internal affairs attorney. That's not her assignment. She needs to continue to do her mission.
Well, there's a lot of things I think she does outside of the mission that she has been ordered to do.
Sure.
She's a little terrible side at everything work, which does. We will get to in a little bit. But you mentioned jurisdiction, and I want to go back to that real quick.
Sure.
So jurisdiction is very clearly defined, you know, in counties and cities, and it's sort of an easy thing to figure out until I spoke to you and you were stationed up in Alaska and you were like, yeah, my jurisdiction is like Japan to Wyoming.
Yeah.
And that seems big. That's a larger thing. So would it make sense that they would have DC lawyers and the whole thing would get moved up to DC or...
No, I mean, sometimes things get moved. I guess it makes sense in some situations that they would have a DC lawyer, but not that the whole court-martial would get moved. The way that it works in the Army, and I know it works a little differently in the Air Force, so I don't know how it works in the... I've been on joint Air Force bases. I've never been on a joint naval base, so I'm not sure how it works in the Navy. But it works something like this. The prosecutor for every case is going to be from the unit where the person who is suspected of committing the crime is. So, like, that unit has a prosecutor assigned to them. That's the person that's going to prosecute anyone who gets accused of a crime in that unit.
Okay.
The defense attorneys are their own command chain. So that they can't report to the guys that are prosecuting the case. You know, they have to be in their own command chain. So they just have kind of like regions that they can get assigned out of. So I was assigned to the Army Region West, which was, you know, all the way like California, Nevada, all the way up to Oregon, Washington, up to Alaska, the two bases we have in Alaska, and then over to Hawaii and a little bit of Korea and Japan for a little bit. And then they changed the region. So Kevin Bacon in this movie should be from the unit that these two guys are from, and then whoever is in that region, the boss of the TDS that region should assign a defense counsel from Cuba.
So does the chain of command ever fuck with like conflicts of interest, or does it sort of supersede?
Yeah.
It feels like you would get assigned cases that have more conflicts that say a civilian attorney or even a public defender in state court would end up having to conflict out of that you guys either by order or whatever would end up taking.
Yeah, like sometimes, you know, we ended up like getting assigned to cases that were not even in our region because all the attorneys in the region were conflicted for whatever reason. Maybe the crime happened within the JAG Corps. Maybe this is a 30-man bar fight, which has happened, where each of these 30 guys needs their own attorney.
Well, we know
and we only
have
15 lawyers
serious,
in the region.
So
yeah,
this can happen, guys.
Yeah. So I got assigned, and sometimes it's a level of an experience. You know, we've got 15 lawyers in this office, but this is too complex of a case. So we're going to ask for a favor outside of our region, ask somebody else to be assigned, that kind of thing. So,
okay.
Yeah, that happens.
So
it only happens on the defense side, not really on the prosecution side.
Okay.
You don't see that.
And does the prosecutor, well, I'll talk about that later because that comes up in the movie and I don't want to step on it. So,
okay.
So she's asking for this job and
yeah,
we're just going to buy that. Let's just buy it because I could get stuck on it for about 2 hours.
Well, and like the idea that she's like a litigator in internal affairs,
right.
Like do they do trials in internal affairs? And then it turns out she's done three trials in two years?
Yeah, that's what I wanted
like
to ask
that?
About was like, the guy's like, yeah, she's a hell of a litigator. She's done three trials in 2 years. Pump the brakes.
Okay.
That's bad litigation. And is it even possible she still has a job? She's done three cases in 2 years.
Uh-huh.
I do love...
I mean, for internal affairs, that might be... She might mostly do advisory opinions or whatever. I mean, that might be a lot.
But we learn
for internal affairs.
But we learn later that, like, she's also done a drunken disorderly that took 6.5 years to do.
That
like...
took 6.5 years. One time, there was the Marines asked to use our courtroom at one of the bases I was working at because they didn't have their own courtroom and the crime had happened. It doesn't matter. They asked to borrow our courtroom for a couple weeks to do a murder trial. And we were like, sure. And it took them 2 weeks. And we were just like, what are they doing in there? Because military trials will go until like midnight if necessary. Like, it's not like civilian court where it's 9 to 5 and your jury is like Joe Schmo off the street. Like, the judge just orders the jury to hang out till midnight. You know, it's like, how did this take 2 weeks, this murder trial? Like, what are they doing in there? And she says she did a drunken disorderly that took, did she say 3 weeks?
It was 8 weeks. Eight
no.
weeks.
No. Oh, my God.
8 weeks. I mean, here, just to give
the
you
idea
an idea.
That even goes to trial is insane.
Because you've never practiced in state court, right? I mean, I know you're in state court now, but you've never done defense work
no,
or trials.
No, I interned
in state court,
okay. In Louisiana, but I never practiced. Well, I was a student attorney in state court.
Okay. Did you do any trials?
Yeah.
Okay. So LA, like, again, this is a county to county thing, but we have in Orange County, we have specific trial courts. So you'll, in a felony case that, let's say it takes 2 years to get to trial in a felony case, I might be in front of 3 or 4 different judges before I get sent to my trial court. If we finally decide we're going to go to trial, they'll be like, okay, please report to Department 55 and you have Judge Smith and that's that. And so that'll be the first time we go see Judge Smith, and Judge Smith does nothing but sit in a courtroom and here gets a motions and trials sent to that court all day. That's all they do.
And that's insane to me. That's because LA is huge.
Well, that's
not how
County.
It works in Louisiana.
The weird thing is in LA, I did a trial up there where they didn't do that, which I thought was interesting. I think they have judges that will just hear trials. But my judge, this was our court day. This was our trial day. And this was a case where it was multiple felonies and the defendant was facing life in prison. We would start at 9:30 in the morning because he had a morning calendar that he wanted to get through of like pre-trials and just setting dates or whatever. Start at 9:30. We would stop at noon. We would come back at 1:30. We would stop at 3. He would take his afternoon calendar until 3:45 and we were done at 4:15.
Yeah, that sounds a lot like how Louisiana works.
Yeah, and it's like you end up having a day where sometimes, you know, if you say you're going to start at 9:30 but you're trying to get through a calendar, you're not going to start until about 10 o'clock. It's just, there's too much setup and work. If you're in a dedicated trial court, 9:30 means 9:30. It's time to call witnesses at 9:30. The bailiff's talking to the jury. They're in the box. It's time to roll.
Right.
I mean, this case ends up taking 3.5 weeks. And
while
it was a very serious case with, you know, obviously a lot of exposure, you know this, there's murder cases where you're like, it's 3 witnesses or 2 witnesses. Like, it, just because there's a severe case doesn't necessarily mean it's going to take a long time.
No, honestly, the severity of the case is usually inverse to the level of complexity of the case.
Right. You know, you're not really getting character witnesses. There's one person that saw something and that's that, whatever. And there's movies that we are going to dissect murder trials, I promise you. But...
Well, this is one of them.
Yeah.
It's a murder.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, was it murder? Was it?
Let's talk about it. Okay. All right. So they're like, okay, we're going to move this whole trial to Washington, D.C., which is nuts. You'd never move a trial from one base to another base unless for some reason the facility there is unable to handle it. Like, we had a case, like the WikiLeaks trial was moved to where I was because we had a classified courtroom, and where the stuff went down, they couldn't do it because they didn't have the machinery and the you know, the stuff needed.
Right.
That's when things get moved. So we're saying these two, they're going to move the accused, the two guys, and they're going to fly up every single witness to D.C. because that's where Joe Galloway and Lieutenant Caffey are. Like, it blew my mind. Instead of flying 2 lawyers down to the trial, we're going to fly every witness and the accused and the judge and everyone up.
So the judge and the jury would come from Gitmo too then?
They should, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we got to meet Lieutenant Caffey here. We get that Joe Galloway's got some crazy ass stats. I do love that her superior's like, who's she doing? Who's she defending? The Rosenbergs? That was funny to me. I appreciate
that.
That
was funny. That was good.
So we get to Caffey, and he's the cool cool guy, right? He's cool guy lawyer.
He's cool.
Playing
baseball. He blew off his appointment with the prosecutor. You know?
Oh, Johnny Yardarm over there that's getting ready to just fucking freak out over somebody with a dime bag of oregano. Now, before we get to the law, I have to give a very brief Tom Cruise little speech here. Tom Cruise is a complicated figure. I get it. I don't want to break down his acting. What I want to break down is the fact that I am convinced that Tom Cruise was created in a laboratory, and he has really nothing going on inside, so that anytime he does something, it's the first time he's done it. So when he's swinging this bat, it's like he's never met a baseball bat before. He's never seen a softball, and he looks at it with such wonder, such just incredible excitement. And he's got this glove on, and he doesn't know how to hold it, and he doesn't even look like he knows how to wear a hat. Like, it's just, it's like a baby, little baby fawn just discovering the world, trying to walk on ice. And it happens throughout this movie, not just with sports. I don't think he's ever, like, he drank a beer like somebody I've never seen drink a beer before. Sits down and, like, throws the whole cup back and is, like, just chomping on peanuts because those are a new food to him. I don't know. I just, go back and watch your Tom Cruise movies, and he's just, like, a little baby that's discovering the world. And it's really makes him a lot funnier.
I noticed none of this baseball stuff that you're going to talk about the whole time, that he's like not holding the baseball bat right and everything. I noticed none of this. What I noticed was this prosecutor who was like ready to put somebody in pretrial confinement, which is there's no bail system in the military. We only throw people in jail before their trial if they're dangerous or a flight risk. He's going to throw somebody in jail before his trial to await trial because he sold a dime bag of oregano. That guy is so young in his career that he has one medal. One medal. And it is a DOD participation ribbon. It's like, you join. Because when you join the military, they give you one ribbon so that your uniform doesn't look stupid. And that's the one ribbon he has, his little DOD service medal. And he wants to file motions. He wants to throw this guy in prison. I would have blown off this meeting, too, if I were Caffey.
Mac, he's coming in hot on this case. Just
he's coming in so hot.
Just strong.
He has nothing better to do.
And here's the funny part. You were a prosecutor for years. I've never been one. But then you went defense, and you know this prosecutor. This prosecutor exists. I have a lot of problems with what this prosecutor does and says, but let me tell you, everyone, this dude exists. Where you get this tiny case, and you have a baby DA, new to the office, new to the job, just out of law school, and they're like, this driving on a suspended license case is going to get me promoted. This person's the worst criminal that's ever existed. I'm taking it to trial. Yeah. I'm going to Joanne Galloway this shit and call in his fifth grade teacher to talk about how he wouldn't take a piss with the hall pass. He was always breaking the laws about licensing, and fuck it. We know this guy.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated Caffey's, like, look, man, you can do all that, but you're not going to get it. I'm going to file a motion to dismiss. That's going to get granted. And even if it doesn't, which I don't think it's going to get dismissed because I think it was selling. So there's an intent element there. But like, he's just like, I'm going to do this. 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 And this is the competency thing that Sorkin will throw in. But like, you get to learn very quickly that I think, as far as I'm concerned, I tried to break it down. Everything you said made sense to me. Like, I didn't see anything really wrong with what Caffey was saying.
All the terms were great. All the terms they were throwing around, they threw around pretrial confinement. They threw around the terms you would use if you were a military lawyer to talk about.
That's what
that
I wanted
case.
To ask you, because, like,
the pretrial motions and everything. But the plea he offers is, like, insane. I think it's, like, 30 days hard labor, like bread and water or something like that, which is a real, or used to be a real Navy penalty, is like bread and water for 3 weeks or something like that. But yeah, the plea you take is no plea in that case, and just see what the prosecutor wants to do. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah, right? It seems like, unless this guy's got like five priors, like, what are we doing here, guy? Come on.
I let those guys just hang themselves. Like, sure, let's go to trial. Let's put this in front of a federal judge and see what they want to do.
Yeah,
let's waste your time. I've let's waste case. Your time on this case.
Yep, I had a case where I went in front of a judge. Where, you know, some guy wanted it, a client put a window in their house without a permit, and the person renting the house got mad at them and turned them into the city. And this guy was like, I can get $1,000 a day in fines. That's what the code says. I'm like, okay, I want to meet the judge who's going to say that my client owes $311,000 because they put a window in their house without a permit. Let's just go do that. So this person exists. I loved it. And I also, we're going to give awards out at the end of the episode. But I think an early nominee for most right thing that happens with Daniel Caffey is his love of Yoo-Hoo. I'm just going to keep bringing that up. Lawyers do drink Yoo-Hoo. Okay.
No, so. Cole drinks Yoo-Hoo.
And Cole is
Cole's
a lawyer.
Cole's been obsessed with Yoo-Hoo since we were teenagers. That is a Cole thing. That is not a lawyer thing.
That's a lawyer thing.
It's not like lawyers drink Yoo-Hoo. That's not, no.
The good ones do.
You know what? I like apples, and Lieutenant Caffey eats an apple, and that's definitely a lawyer thing.
Another thing he does, like he's never met an apple before. So you're just...
I loved the apple bit. Don't fucking come for the apple bit. I loved it.
I love
he's
it
like
too.
Eating an apple, and his hands are sticky, and then he does the like the hand, like he's like rubbing them together.
He does the Miyagi thing, and notice how though that the apple grows? He like finishes the apple when he first sits down. Yeah, there's an edit problem. Again, that's not what this podcast is, but
that's
they
not
get
what
him from behind.
And
you're
about.
Like, oh, that apple just exploded. That's fantastic.
I was so charmed by him that I couldn't. I didn't notice any continuity errors.
Which
okay
is a lawyer tactic, by the way. Anyway, go ahead.
So we clip to, you know, like the defense meeting. We've got Caffey in there. What's Kevin Pollak's name?
Lieutenant Weinberg.
Lieutenant Weinberg is there. You got the other defense guys. You got who would be the senior defense counsel assigning cases. This is how this would go. We got a new case. We're going to assign it to you guys. And we, I think during this one, we find out that Caffey has pled 44 cases in 9 months.
No, that is that goes to the meeting with Galloway, which is where we go next.
Okay, which is next.
Yeah, but we do learn that he's done 44 cases in 9 months, which to me doesn't sound like an incredible stat because we plead all the time in state court. Is it different in military court?
Well, yeah, I think that is a pretty good, like, it's a pretty incredible stat, especially where he's at in D.C., which is a pretty sleepy jurisdiction as far as military criminal courts go. Because it's mostly civilians out there instead of the uniformed guys. And they tend to be older and a little more high ranking, just like a little less likely to get into stupid trouble all the time. You know, like drugs and bars and that kind of thing.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Doing the drunken disorderly.
They all have security clearances that they don't want to mess up by doing something stupid. So, you know, I think in a pretty sleepy jurisdiction, that's a pretty high number. Also, a plea in military court takes at least one trial day, sometimes two, because have something called providence where the judge talks the defendant through the crime, and they basically have to prove to the court that they did in fact do the crime, and that's to minimize the possibility that somebody has been intimidated into a plea by their higher ranking lawyer. Like you'll see later in the movie, the accused like standing up at attention and being very intimidated by the ranks of Galloway and Caffey, like that kind of thing. If a captain looks at you and says, you're going to plead this case because it would be stupid for you to do anything else, you know, some people might just freak out and be like, yes, sir. So they take you through like, what did you do next? What did you do next? And if that person in that chair can't prove to the judge that they did it with their own testimony, they don't get to plead.
Oh, so it actually is, it's actually testimony. They can't do a written statement or anything?
They can do a written sentencing statement, but they have to testify about what they did. And so there's no plea nolo, there's no like, I didn't do it, but I still want to plead in the military. There's none of that.
Okay, because what we end up doing is you can plea and we just have what's called a factual basis, and it's a little paragraph, and you're just like, on this such and such a date, I did unlawfully, and then you just like insert the elements of the crime, you know, unlawfully take from target a iPod and blah, blah, blah. But you can do a plea in a misdemeanor. I don't even need the defendant there to take a plea. Right. I can do a notarized tall that I've signed with them in the office, and I just hand it to the judge, and they're like, did you read this to your client? Yep. Did you explain to him what was going to happen? Yep. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Good. So, you know, you can end up doing quite a few of them. I'm not saying 44 is a low number, but they, like, to me, not practicing in military court, it sounds like they're trying to put him on Mount Olympus. And I'm like, it's a good number.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like, I don't know that it's steak knife.
The steak knife line is like a line that won't die in at least the Army JAG Corps. Like, that's something that gets quoted a lot. Like,
I have a feeling there's a lot in this movie that has both made Army JAG a lot of fun and miserable for many,
particularly
many
women. There's a few lines in this one that just aren't great for ladies.
And it hits hard, man. That just hits hard. That's a hard listen. So they meet with Jo Galloway, and she's all, you know, I'm going to basically be in your shit to make sure that you do this right. And, you know, she outranks them.
Yes.
Both of them, because Weinberg, being 57 years old, is still the same rank.
Lieutenant Weinberg, just the youngest lieutenant ever to serve in the military. I don't know how a 55-year-old man got, because he's fairly, like, you look at his awards and stuff, he's fairly young in his career. Cole has snorted, I believe, coffee through his nose. He's trying very hard to get it back.
It's black vanilla tea, and it's burning in my nose now.
So Lieutenant Weinberg is in the first, like, has to be within the first 2 years of his career, just based on rank alone. He's old. He's an old man. I don't know why.
There's an argument to be had here, though, that Kevin Pollak was 21 years old when this
because
movie
he's
was
never
filmed.
Aged.
Because he feels like the type of a Wallace Shawn person who just has looked that old.
Sure.
Forever.
But they are lieutenants junior grade, and Joe Galloway is lieutenant commander. The Army equivalent is these guys are both first lieutenants. You're only a first lieutenant in the Army JAG Corps for maybe 9 months at the most before you get promoted to captain. So these guys are really young in their career. I just got promoted to major like within the last 6 months. I can't remember 2020 being what it is. I can't remember when it was. In the like seventh or eighth year of my career. So that's the difference in experience here. We're talking about some guys just starting their career, and Joe Galloway's probably been in for about 8 years.
Okay.
Which is insane considering how bad she is at everything.
That was gonna be my next question, was like, how does she still have a job?
No one knows.
So they meet with Joe and they're like, okay, we're going to Cuba. And this is something that I get asked constantly by clients, and it's so fucking annoying. If you guys, I'm trying to put this nicely in case we have a listener or two out there that have been in trouble criminally and gone to the lawyer and done this. I'm not actually making fun of you. I think this is a problem with TV and movies, which is your lawyers go and investigate the crime. I'm going to ask you the question about JAG in a minute, but I want to make very clear that I don't do that. And your defense attorney shouldn't do that. You should have separate investigators, because the problem becomes becoming a witness. So if I'm a lawyer and I go talk to Noah Wiley and I say, Noah, I have all these questions for you, and he answers them all in a certain way. And then I get him on the stand in trial and I say, Noah, how's it going, buddy? Ask you these questions, and he answers them in a totally different way.
And what do you do?
Now I have to call myself to the stand to testify that I interviewed Noah Wiley on such and such a date, and during that interview, he told me X, Y, and Z. And once I become a percipient witness to the case, I can't be
percipient.
Your lawyer.
Percipient? You said a word. Look at you. Yeah.
You like that? A little, you know, studied. Just let me just cross that off real quick. So I get asked all the time by clients, like, why do I have to hire an investigator? Why can't you just go do it? Why can't you call the person? Why can't you do this? That's why. It's not because I'm being lazy. It's not because your lawyer's being lazy. Although you may have a lazy attorney. I'm not sure. But that's not indicative of laziness. That's indicative of wanting to preserve the attorney-client relationship and not end up becoming a witness to your case. Is it different in military? Like, did you have to go do your own investigation?
Yeah, we do all our own investigation.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So I wanted to get that out of the way first.
Yeah, but the way that we avoid the problem that you're talking about is we bring paralegals with us to all of those interviews. Sometimes, you know, depending on the witness, you can just, the paralegals act as investigators in the military. They don't do a lot of the stuff that they do in the civilian world. Like a lot of the discovery stuff is done by attorney. You know, it's just a little bit different. But for the most part, your paralegals are your investigators. They can do some witness interviews on their own. I mean, they could do all of them on their own. I just liked to go to the important ones because often you don't get more than one shot at a witness interview. So if I have an extra question after I look at their notes, then, you know, I'm fresh out of luck. So then if I'm questioning somebody and they say something different than they said to me last week, I can say, you remember coming to my office last week and saying something different. And then if they say, you know, if they don't recant right there, then I can pull that paralegal who's sitting in the front row
up to
testify.
And I will do some interviews with an investigator there or a third party, which does cure that problem. But it becomes a waste of resources to always have two people there. And I happen to have a really good investigator who's great at what he does and prepares great reports and all that stuff. So having somebody you trust also helps the process. But you should never, as an attorney, go out there and do it alone unless there's some rule, local rule or whatever, that allows you to sidestep that particular landmine.
a lot of like law firm investigators are former cops or former, you know, private investigators or, you know, whatever, have some kind of investigatory background. Military paralegals are people who raise their hand to say, I want to join the Army. And then they got put into paralegal instead. Like they could have been an infantryman. They could have been a like bomb guy or a medic or a, you know, like they could have done anything. They, you take a test and you've got to be really smart to get slotted to be a paralegal. But I would say very few people join the military to be a paralegal or even know that that's a thing when you're 18 years old and you go down to your recruiter's office. So, you know, these guys don't have a background. We obviously train them in how to be a paralegal and how to be an investigator, but they don't have the same like 20 years of experience as a cop of a lot the defense investigators that are out there. So, yeah, so we end up doing a lot of our own stuff.
So before we get down to Cuba, where a lot of the shit gets off the rails as far as being good law, Joe, I have to ask about the co-defendants being assigned the same counsel. Is that?
Oh, my God.
That's just not a thing.
No, like I said, if somebody's in a 30-man bar fight, they got to go find defense counsels from, you know, Germany or whatever to come fly in and do the case. It's insane.
Yeah.
And these guys, when they like jointly murdered a dude, allegedly,
just point fingers.
I think their best defense is probably to point at the other guy and say, he told me to do it. And lo and behold, once we get to fucking trial, one of them's like, you told me to do it. And it's like, well, mistrial, let's get these guys separate counsel. Like,
yeah, you just don't do, you have to put in a waiver to the court. It's called a conflict waiver. You can sign it. It's not that it's illegal. It's just highly inadvisable.
Yeah,
and I don't know any lawyers who like doing it. I've done it exactly once, and it was a very specific case. The second client was like not criminally charged. It was more of, you know, it was a white collar crime, and there was a lot of crap going on. And I'm not going to bore you all with it, but I didn't even feel great about doing it then.
No, it's not great.
It's just way too much liability. And again, as you said, Downey's defense literally is, I was ordered by that guy. Like, you want to talk about Jessup ordering the code red? The code red was ordered to me from him. So
yeah,
talk to Hal, if you don't mind.
Talk to him.
So yeah, the concept that they would just assign two Codys drove me crazy. But anyway, they do, and it is what it is. And we get down to Cuba to do the big investigation. So they get down there and they start sort of asking questions. And I feel like Lieutenant Commander Galloway, and I'm not trying to dog on Demi Moore or anything like that, but she's just a bad character who's doing bad things and doing bad law and being a jerk about it in Cuba. I don't get it.
If this character, Joe Galloway, was based on Sorkin's sister, he has some explaining to do to his sister. Because, like, at this point where they're having this lunch with this colonel, they suspect that there may have been some kind of order they would like there to have been some kind of order coming from the chain of command, right? Like, that would be the best for their client. They would like this paperwork to exist, right? And so, like, Kathy's trying to play it cool and be like, hey, yeah, would you mind just getting us that manifest and the transfer order? And, you know, and she is like, that isn't very important to our case. I would like to signal you, somebody who is a witness, that is something you might need to either manufacture or destroy before we get to trial. Like, it is insane. She's like, here are all of my poker cards. Please look at them.
Well, and it's not even like a random witness. It's not Cuba Gooding Jr. No. that she's talking to. It's, I suspect this guy did the crime. And he's accomplished and smart. Evil, but smart. And like you said, here's all the things I'm looking for. So in case you want to keep us at lunch any longer, feel free to do that. Maybe we'll get some cigars and coffee. And she, like, even when they were touring the barracks, and Kathy's like just sort of looking at stuff and looks in the closet and's like, well, you can pack this up. I'm done here. We don't need any of this. And she's like, you're just going to take the guided tour? We're not confused as to who killed the guy. This is not, we're not looking for DNA evidence.
Right.
Do I need to be snapping pictures of this scene? I'm assuming the predecessor to NCIS got this. Mark Harmon's been down here. He did the deal. We're good.
And also, like, who's paid? Jo Galloway is not assigned to this case.
Thank you. She is
not assigned to this unit. She does not represent either of these clients. Who is paying for Jo Galloway to fly to Cuba for this weekend? Like, that's not nothing.
Why is Joe leading the case and not the guy who assigned it to Kathy?
Wouldn't
Kathy's superior just be like, hey, checking in on your caseload. How are we doing on that crazy Gitmo shit? And he'd be like, well, we're fine. And
Kathy's like really, really accommodating to Galloway. And I don't know if it's because she outranks him or what, but I would have been like, ma'am, respectfully, get the fuck off my case. Like, stop talking to my clients. Stop talking to my witnesses. Stop following me around. So, like, I don't understand why you're here.
He does finally get there. And we kind of skipped ahead because we went to Cuba, but they do have this conversation before they get to Cuba. Because when Downey and Dawson get sent to D.C. and he's back out on the softball field, she comes to him and she's like, hey, can you please explain to me why your clients have been sitting in a cell for 6 hours while you're out here playing softball? And first of all, like, I'm sure you've been to either lockup or jail to talk to clients or, you know, whatever. Like, first of all, it's cumbersome to go, and I'll go when I go. Like, don't you worry about how I'm dealing with my clients.
Also,
all
right? You know who isn't available to talk to you 6 hours after they set foot in a jail? Your client, because they're in processing. They're getting their shit together. They're getting their jumpsuits and their towels and their whatever. Like, they need a good 3 days before they can talk to anybody.
Unless you walk them in, you're not getting to talk to them. That's not
you're
how
not
it works.
On the list, guy.
Yeah, they don't hold them in the lobby.
Yeah, he's not assigned a cell. He's not anywhere near to being able to talk to a lawyer yet.
You know, what I appreciate is they go and they talk to him. And this is where, you know, they stand up and you talked about Ranks earlier. And I want to briefly go through this because I know this could be like a 2-hour thing. But Ranks confused the shit out of me for multiple reasons. One, I don't understand the inter-branch ranking because I know they don't go in the same. It's not the same system, basically, the same ranking system. So a captain in the Army is not going to be the same level as a captain in, say, the Navy, right?
Kind of. I mean, so, like, for let's say for a colonel in the Army, you've got, like, a little eagle bird on you that's, like, sewn onto your, you know, wherever that goes in your uniform.
Okay.
It's different depending on the branch you're in. But, like, that little eagle bird in the Army is called a colonel, but in the Navy is called a captain. Because that's the biggest thing you can be on a ship besides an admiral. So the symbol is going to be the same. So you can, I'm a major in the Army Reserves. I have a little gold leafy thing. You'll see that Jo Galloway, who is a lieutenant commander in the Navy, has the same gold leafy thing. We are equivalent ranks. So even if I may not know to say lieutenant commander, like even if like that's a little bit rough, major versus lieutenant commander, I know gold leafy thing, that's the same as me. Silver leafy thing, that's one up. I should salute that person. Now, with the enlisted ranks, it gets a little hairier, but they have rockers or like little lines and how many stripes they have. And that's kind of how they tell. But the Navy gets real squirrely on enlisted ranks. It gets a little nuts in terms of what you call them because it's by job and it's a mess. But you should be able to look at somebody who's not in your branch and pretty easily tell whether you have to salute them or not.
And it's you're always saluting up, right? You're always just saluting superiors. Superiors don't salute down.
Yeah. You're the first person to salute if you are the junior person.
Okay.
And then that person the senior person has to salute back.
That feels like an inordinate amount of power.
It's a mutual respect.
Superior person.
Yeah. The junior person cannot lower their salute. I mean, you know, by the book, you cannot lower your salute until your senior person salutes back. It gets embarrassing when somebody salutes you and you didn't notice, and then somebody's yelling at you from, like, down the sidewalk, like, never salute me back, ma'am. I can never move. My hand's going to be here for the rest of my life. It's like, okay, yeah, you're really showing a lot of respect there, Sergeant. Here you go. Here's your salute.
I mean, there's a bunch of reasons I would do poorly in the military. As someone who's known me for far too long, you could probably agree with that. And here's why. Even that little amount of power is too much for me.
Yeah, I get it.
Like, I would abuse the shit out of that. They'd be like, Cole, where you been? I'd be like, just been fucking with these privates out here. I just won't salute them. It's great. I love it. Not let them
yeah,
go.
Yeah,
one of them tried to leave and I yelled at him. It was great.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I can't do it. But they get in there and they're having the talk with them. And this is something that I thought was really fairly interesting. And I'm wondering if it's as frustrating as it looked like for me, because when I'm starting a defense and I meet my client, the first thing I want to do is just like, tell me the story. I don't ask a ton of questions. It's like, start at the beginning, give it all to me. What is your story? And that's usually a fairly broad narrative that they tell, and you can sort of start deciphering for yourself what I think is true, what I think probably isn't, or what's in the gray area, whatever. This was just a series of one-word answers, which makes it very difficult, because it makes it seem like Dawson and Downey do not even understand what the fuck is going on, and that, hey guys, you've been charged with a crime, it's our job to defend you, you're making it fucking impossible.
Yeah.
Does that happen with the one-word answers? Because of the ranking, like, I don't have
the one-word answers, definitely, for sure. I mean, a lot of times, you know, depending on your client, I've had clients that outranked me by quite a lot, but normally your clients are going to skew younger, you know, just like the average guy that comes into your office. And those guys often do not have casual conversations with people that are the ranks of their attorneys, which are usually captains and majors. And it gets a little rough. I mean, especially most of the trials I did, the overwhelming number of trials I did when I was in the Army were sexual assault trials. And so it gets, I mean, with victims and with accused, because if you're a prosecutor, you got to sit down and talk to the victim who's, you know, also skew young.
Sure.
And so, like, you've got somebody with who's already uncomfortable talking to you because of the rank that you both are, and you need to have a casual conversation about not only like a possible crime being committed, but also like sexual history and like, you know, even if it's just drugs or something, like, that's not a great, you're basically their boss. It's not a great, in their mind, you know, like, you're a defense attorney and you just need to know what they did. But in their mind, they're like, well, if I say this to a senior officer, like, what's going to happen to me here? Like, is this going to get worse for me? So it's hard for them to get out of the mindset of, like, you're on their team, you're not going to use any of this against them, and you should be comfortable talking.
So as the defender, did you get a lot of clients that would think, like, oh, you're sort of in cahoots with the prosecutor?
Oh,
you
all guys the time, yeah.
Okay, because I get that a ton with, as a private attorney, you get people who were assigned a PD and then decided either to find some money or had some family and they want to hire a private attorney. And a lot of times they come to us and they say, you know, I know that PD, they work with the DAs all the time and they're just trying to screw us. Like, they just make deals that have nothing to do with our case. And we get that a ton. So I imagine it's even more in a situation where there's ranks and things like that, which we certainly don't deal
with. Especially because, like, in the JAG Corps, you get assigned, I mean, I became a defense counsel in the same office where I was a prosecutor, you know, the week before.
Right.
And, you know, you go across the aisle all the time. And so your friends end up being like, my friend from basic training might be the prosecutor. So they see you around base having lunch together around town, like hanging out, because those are your friends. You know, there's only like five lawyers on base. You're going to hang out. And so that's always an awkward thing where you're friendly toward the other side, when in actuality, it really helps your client.
Oh, if
the prosecutor trusts you and they know that you're not going to play games and stuff, it's much better for them.
Oh, I have that conversation all the time. You have clients that come in and they want you to be an asshole to the prosecutor constantly. And you're like, that will only hurt you.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to try and get you either the best deal if that's where this case is going, or if we're going to trial, I'm going to try and win your trial. That's the game. Like, I get in trouble if I don't do that. I also like, you know, lose my business if I get a reputation for being like, this guy loses a lot of trials, you should you should look somewhere else. But there, you just get this, you know, it's probably 20% of my clients are like, why are you laughing with that attorney? Because he said something funny. Like, it's okay that we like each other. Once we're on the record, you're not gonna see me like raise my hand and go, objection, can I just say my client did the whole thing, he told me. can we just go to lunch? That's not going to happen. But yeah, it's hard to sort of put myself in their shoes, particularly when they're facing the exposure and I've never had to deal with that. Like, that worried about, you know, wondering if their attorney gets it, because there's a lot of attorneys out there that, you know, lose cases and they just go home. It's not, we don't do the time. Like, I don't have to go to jail if my client loses a trial. And sometimes you go to trial on cases because you have to, and they're not really winnable. That's a real thing.
Right.
But, you know, you're not going to take a deal that says, you can plead to life. I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'll take my chances at trial. But
Exactly.
So we have to talk a little bit about the UCMJ and what I can only assume is the Aunt Jenny exception.
Aunt Jenny is something that gets thrown around a lot. At least in my office, there was a guy that really liked making Aunt Jenny jokes. In the movie, Joe Galloway, who is not assigned to this case, who does not represent these clients, talks to one of their aunts, Aunt Jenny, and Aunt Jenny hires her on behalf of her nephew to represent him on the case, which is not something she can do. That's a military assignment.
Yep.
I don't know if she's, Colonel Admiral Jenny as well, and happens to be assigned to this unit. But I don't think she is. I don't think she's Admiral Jenny, Internal Affairs.
Yeah, they didn't get into that at all.
If they did, it wasn't mentioned, if that's the case. And also, if I were Kathy, so first of all, the client has to hire you. Aunt Jenny might be paying for it.
Yep.
But the client, this guy, has to say, I want Joe Galloway to be my attorney. Maybe Aunt Jenny talked him into it. Maybe if she's a private attorney, she's paying for it. But he has to hire her.
That would be the if this were not the military payer portion of the contract.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. But since she's an active duty Navy member, her unit has to assign her to that, which means if he wanted, which you can do, if he wanted a specific attorney, say one of my old clients got in trouble again and thought I was so fantastic on his case, which I probably was, that they would want me back again.
Obviously.
They could file something to say, hey, this attorney is still around. She's still in the reserves. We want you to call her back on active duty to represent me. And they might do it. Like, that's something that can be done. You can request a specific military attorney.
So that's the Aunt Jenny motion. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. But you have to have represented them before in the past. There has to be a relationship with that client. There has to be all this kind of stuff. This guy would have to want Joe Galloway, for a reason. It's just colossally stupid.
I also feel as though knowing you throughout your entire JAG career, that it did not appear to be a part-time job.
No, it was not.
Which means you didn't really have sort of a side gig.
No, could not have a side gig.
So this is definitely not Joe in her spare time doing the law office of Joe Galloway.
No, that's impossible. Sure. You cannot do that.
You're not allowed to do that. Okay, again.
You're not allowed to.
Assumed.
Yeah.
But wanted to double check with the expert. This is what you guys are coming here for, learning that if you are in the Army, you can't hire yourself out privately. We got that.
No, it's smart, but no. So Aunt Jenny hires Joe to represent her nephew and apparently the other guy on the case as well. That's just assumed. What? Oh, no, wait. She does only represent him, right?
She only represents
the one.
But I do appreciate, when Kathy finds out, or just before he finds out, he's like, Joe, I appreciate it, but you ever talk to one of my clients again, and I will have you disbarred. And you're coming dangerously close to interfering in a government investigation. And it's like, no, she's not coming dangerously close. She's just doing it.
Yeah, which is a crime under the UCMJ.
Yeah, she is doing it.
She is.
That is what's happening. And then, she's like, well, I'm Loudon Downey's attorney. Impressive that Sorkin didn't just write, the fuck you are. Because that's not a thing.
Right, that's what I would have said. Yep.
And I just love, I think as a kid and I didn't understand it, I was like, man, Tom Cruise is really making fun of Aunt Jenny. Oh, Aunt Jenny. Mm-hmm. Maybe his Uncle Goober can be the judge. As a lawyer now, I get it. I'd be so pissed at Joe Galloway for pulling all this shit, for going behind my back, for doing all these things that will get you, if not disbarred, certainly sanctioned. And disciplined by the Bar Association, or, the State Bar, whoever, whatever the barring agency is. Because to be I'm assuming you just need to be barred by one state, pass one bar exam to be. So whoever bars her would be in charge of some of her bar discipline. I don't know if JAG then licenses you separately or how that works.
You're federal. We're Article III courts now.
Okay, so. Gotcha. So anyway, Joe's somehow miraculously on the case. I want to talk very briefly about my appreciation for Lieutenant Weinberg, which will continue to come as we go through the trial. But the fact that he's like, I got this case. I have no responsibilities. Perfect.
Yeah.
That's a great lawyer to be. You can be a very successful lawyer who's just like, I'll second chair the shit out of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do the research and I'll prep witnesses. And that's an incredibly important skill that not a lot of attorneys have. And I'm not convinced Caffey has that. I think Caffey's a good lawyer. I think he's got a lot of things that help his clients. And I don't think Weinberg could have won the case. I know Joe couldn't win the case. Caffey can win the case. But what Weinberg says, I think multiple times in the movie, that it's totally true, is there's a difference between trial law and paper law.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
But at the same time, you know, Weinberg has the best take on this case. Like, when Galway and Caffey are fighting back and forth about, you know, the order for the Code Red coming through and how they were ordered to do it and how, like, Caffey's not taking it personally enough and isn't, like, doesn't believe in the case. Like, all this stuff, he's the one guy that has the take that's like, hey, guys, you're not supposed to follow illegal orders.
Right.
If somebody who is a higher rank than you tells you to go murder children, you can't do that. Like, has anyone heard of my lie? You cannot go do illegal things based on orders if you know that it's an illegal order, which at trial they proved that this guy did know it was an illegal order. And Caffey and Galway just seemed to, like, not hear that.
No, he was literally just there, like, didn't work for Mila, didn't work for Nuremberg. And like, Jesus, Sam.
Nuremberg, you can't.
What's your, just Sam, these, follow these orders. These guys aren't the Nazis. Well, they followed an order that was illegal and they killed somebody. Yeah. So.
Yeah, they're not the Nazis, but they are murderers.
Yeah, they, like, did do the that murder.
That did happen.
The take I loved from Weinberg was, and I've, you know, as an individual, you see cases where you're like, yeah, they think they did what they were ordered to do, and I think they should spend the entirety of their life in jail.
Yes.
Yes.
These are all true.
I believe they ordered the Code Red, and they should go to prison for the rest of their life. Believe every word of what they're saying. And I think it's a great point. Like, he has the level-headed, perfect examination of the case, and that's a lot of what lawyers do, particularly on the defense side. Well, I mean, they do it on prosecution side too. Is like, what is this case worth? What actually happened in this case? Because a lot of times, and I'm just speaking from my own experience, you know, the charging document, the complaint, or, you know, the information in a felony trial is sort of like a negotiation instrument. So there's a certain element of charging what I think I can prove versus charging what happened.
Right.
Or what I think happened. And we can have discussions on later pods about, like, prosecutorial ethics and things like that. But, you know, part of what you're trying to determine when you want to go in and negotiate a case, you need to have as best an idea as to what happened or what you can prove. Like, that's something Caffey keeps saying that's true. Like, Joe, I don't give a shit what you think. It only matters what I can show. That's all that matters. Because we have a dead body. We have the guys that were there. They called. They were at the scene. Yeah. Like,
this isn't a whodunit.
This is not a whodunit. So we actually, because, again, technically under your constitutional rights, the defendant doesn't have to prove anything. The prosecution has to prove the thing. That's their burden. But if you're fairly certain they're going to meet the burden and you have to have an affirmative defense, like if it's self-defense or if it's, you know, in this case I was ordered, you know, you don't get that in civilian court, but I was ordered to do the thing. You have to be able to prove that. And if you can't prove it, you can't just go up there and say, I know it. I know it in my heart. That's what happened. And
no,
Joe doesn't seem to get that.
Matthew McConaughey can, and we'll get to that in another episode.
Obviously.
But yeah, you can't get up there on argument and be like, I know, I believe.
Yeah, it's called vouching.
Aaron. Yeah. But I want to talk a little bit about the plea negotiation, because originally Caffey goes up to Kevin Bacon's character, who is named...
Lieutenant Jack Reese? Ross. Jack
Reese,
Ross.
Yeah. Ross.
That lousy fucking softball player.
I just want to throw this in here. Jack Ross never wears a nameplate, ever, in the entire movie. You know, where it says, like, Caffey on his uniform and Galloway? Ross nary a nameplate in any uniform. And I don't understand. I don't understand if it's because he's like a Marine, but I'm pretty sure they have nameplates. Like it blew my mind.
Everybody knows anyway, Captain Jack. Everybody.
I just wanted to put it out there. Sure. Anyway, so Caffey, without talking to his client, says, "I'll take 12 years on this," which is a good deal.
For murder.
You have to. You can't, yeah, on a murder, 12 years, just an outstanding, that's great.
Dynamite number.
But he didn't bring that deal to his client first, which is kind of nuts. And then, you know, a few scenes later, we have the, I don't know if you're ready to talk about the basketball court plea negotiation.
Always ready to. It's where I do my best work.
At some point, so Caffey tells Ross, hey, these guys were ordered to do this, and we can prove it. And Ross at one point, I think it's right there, offers him 2 years for manslaughter.
Yes. Manslaughter, two years, they'll be home in 6 months.
The sweetest deal.
Yes. Yeah.
Take that and run.
Yeah.
Like pass the basketball back to the prosecutor and literally run off the court as fast as you can to your client before he can take it back.
I would call the judge. I'd say, go to court. Go to court. This is going to be
now,
worth it.
Let's do this now. Let's do a night court.
Yes.
Please. Let's get this done. Because that's what those guys did. I mean, there's no way that the prosecution can't prove that they were there and they put the sock in the kid's mouth. And that's all you need
for manslaughter. Manslaughter is an unintentional killing.
Yeah.
You didn't mean to, but you did it. And that's what happened. Like
6 months?
6 months. 6 months. And not only is it an incredible deal, and I'm glad that you got to that point, because there is few things more frustrating than working your ass off for a client who you know did the thing. Like, we know Dawson and Downey did the killing. Mm-hmm. We know, yes, they were ordered to do it. What the fuck ever. They did the killing. So,
and Cole's not talking about knowing that they did it because they told you they did it. We don't care. What we're saying is there's evidence.
There's evidence that they did.
That proves, that any jury is going to find that this person did the thing. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yes. Your defense, sometimes you get a case where your defense is, it wasn't me. That would be a fruitless defense in this case. So,
right. Or it wasn't me that put the sock in the mouth. Like,
exactly.
I wasn't there. I didn't do the action.
Yes.
You know, the kid put the sock in his own mouth or whatever. You can't, they cannot.
Right.
Refute that evidence. There's
exactly.
Nothing there.
Exactly. So when you have that and you have an exact understanding of what happened and what they did, and you get an incredible deal, and I've been there, and I know every lawyer out there listening to this has been there, and this isn't just a criminal thing. Like, you could have a great settlement in a civil case where you're like, oh my God, I only got to pay him, you know, 80 grand. This should be 4 million. You get this incredible deal and the client won't take it.
Won't take it.
I mean, it's demoralizing because it's hard to negotiate cases. It looks easy on television, as most things do. Like, don't get me wrong. Everything looks easy in the movies and on TV. But when you have dead bodies, it gets real hard because you have victims' families. You have all of these people who want to see somebody pay for a death, which I totally get.
Yep.
And when you have, like, when Dawson looks at him and is like, nah. Screw that. I'm not going to stand up and say I'm dishonorable or I have no code or whatever. I would have done the exact same thing Caffey did, which was like, get this guy another fucking attorney. Let's just...
Yeah.
Conflict. We have... Our working relationship has broken down. There is no ability for us to coexist on this case, and I'm declaring a conflict. Get me the fuck out of here.
And I'm sure you've had this conversation with clients where it's like, okay, you're going to do 30 years. Do you want to do 30 years or do you want to do 2 years? Because I'm telling you, like, I'm a really good lawyer and you're going to do 30 years because there's nothing I can do about this evidence.
No,
and they don't take
one case in particular sticks out. And, it, you know,
I think everybody has one.
Yeah. And he was a great client and it's a bad set of facts. And there's cases, guys, where you just have bad facts. There's just bad facts, and you can't get around them. And the way that at least sentencing the triads here in California, plus the enhancements that become mandatory for certain allegations, my guy's looking basically for a fight. It was looking at 19 years. And he's a young kid. And 3 weeks after the fight, the victim died. And there was a causation problem, and we were able not to have it as a murder case, and we're looking at this. But because there were some enhancements and some severe injuries... for what is essentially a fight. They got in a mm-hmm. fight in an alley. He's looking at 19 years.
Yep.
And I had to go to him and be like, proving this assault is not hard. Like, anybody could prove this assault. The worst district attorney in the world can prove this assault. So under this statutory scheme, you're going to do 4 years at a minimum. And then all they have to do is if they prove this one enhancement, that's plus five. Then it's mm-hmm. plus 10 on this other one. And like, so he, you know, we ended up pleading him to 4 years, which was an incredible deal given the facts. And like, I'm very happy, but it's one of those where I could see a lot of clients going, no, fuck that. I don't want that. I didn't. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're looking at 19 years in prison, man. I mean, this is a very serious thing. And there, you get these cases and they just, that one will stay with me for a long time. And he's a wrong place, wrong time, bad facts, bad circumstances. And all the lawyering in the world, you can't necessarily undo the thing, particularly when you have a dead body. You just can't.
Yep.
And the serious part of this podcast is over.
Also, during that conversation, I was going to say, the what you touched on a little bit, that the guy is like, I'm not going to say that I have no honor.
Right.
And then he refuses to. So, okay, here's the thing. This kid will, on the order of a senior officer, go to the room of a junior enlisted soldier and beat the shit out of him in the name of hazing because he was ordered to do so. Right. Okay. And he has honor and he follows orders. But then he won't salute his attorney on his way out the door because he's pissed off at him and he puts his hand in his pocket instead. This, I think the movie wants you to think that these two kids are like super honorable and like have a code. Like that keeps, that's underscored throughout the movie. These two guys, I mean, I'm Teen Weinberg. Like,
yeah.
You followed that order. You didn't go to an admiral. You didn't run that up the chain of command. Hey, they're ordering me to haze this kid. But you'll just refuse to salute an officer. That's cool.
Yeah. You're picking and choosing your code, my man. So it's very difficult for me to care. And that's why I always liked that Kathy until the end. I feel for the guys too. Like, I'm not saying like following orders. And I love this part in the movie where he's like, look, man, like orders here in my office or orders here in the Washington Navy Yard don't mean much. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We have freaking battalions doing gun shit in the yard.
Good job.
Technical terms?
That's how it is. Yeah. Battalions doing gun shit. Yeah.
Gun shit is.
I don't think it's battalions in the Marines, but yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah.
But those are real words though, right?
Those were words. Yeah.
Awesome.
In the Army, it's a battalion. I just feel like in the Marines, it's something vaguely nautical. I don't know. I don't have the pleasure of knowing any Marines.
So they had some vaguely nautical battalions in the yard doing gun shit. But mm-hmm. out in Guantanamo, orders fucking mean stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure those guys were in a bad spot. But you can't, like you said, beat your chest about honor and be like, but when it gets tough, I'm just going to do the killing stuff. I'll just do that.
Well, once we get to the trial, he said it comes out that this guy was ordered to do a code red previously, refused to do it because he knew that it was wrong and he knew it was an illegal order. And then he got punished for not following that order. So this time, selfishly, he's going to go ahead and do the code red, knowing that it's an illegal order, to save himself the Article 15 or the paper in his file or whatever reprimand he's going to get.
Right.
This guy's a murderer. I'm sorry. He's a murderer.
I know that he didn't
mean for the kid to die.
Keep trying to say he's such a good Marine because he refused to do this code red on this other guy that he liked. And it's like, yes, but then he chose to kill the guy who had evidence of him illegally firing his gun.
Over the fence line. Yeah, he didn't like Santiago. He couldn't run fast, and he was a shitty Marine, and he had shit on him.
Sounds like murder. Now, hey, we all know you're Team Jessup, and we're going to get there. We know you're Team Jessup. Mm-hmm. But
like, let's walk it back a little bit. I'm not Team Jessup.
I don't want to walk it back. I just want people to know you're Team Jessup.
Just the Cuba lunch alone. I'm not like
that's. I want to go
the blowjob from the senior officer line. Like the entire female membership of the JAG Corps thanks you, Colonel Jessup, for that line.
Yeah,
Team Jessup.
I wanted to ask you like how much has that just ruined life for females in the military?
I don't know. I would say, like, occasionally it does ruin life, you know?
Sometimes. Probably, unfortunately, more than it should.
More than it should, yes. Yeah.
Let's talk about the Cuba thing real quick. So I just have one more question about rank. It's my understanding that colonel is not the highest rank in the Marines, so that he wouldn't have to wait until someone was elected president. Like, Colonel Jessup has superior officers in the Marines.
Yes. Four different kinds of generals, sometimes five.
Yeah.
Different kinds of generals.
Even as a kid, when he was like, you know, I'm unfortunately a colonel, so I'm going to have to wait till somebody's elected president. I'm like, I've heard of general. I've heard the word general. I swear to God, I've heard it. I know that means high.
Yeah. He's got a lot of generals in charge of him. However, I feel like I've heard colonels say shit like that, you know?
Brand. 100%.
Yeah. The air is thin up there. I feel like they would say things like that. I mean, not generally, but like an asshole might.
Right.
I can see that being said.
So let's get to court. Let's get this thing into court. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things about any movie or TV show ever is when they make even newscast today about like the Felicity Huffman trial. They make a huge deal out of entering a plea of not guilty. That happens in 100% of cases.
100%. Every case.
Yeah. The only exceptions I can think of are if you can park a case at the arraignment stage, which in some courts you can and some courts you can't.
And you're talking about speeding tickets. You're talking about,
I'm talking about DUIs.
Low-level stuff. Yeah.
I'm talking about misdemeanors. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But occasionally you can work with a district attorney before your arraignment and come to a deal. And if you come to a deal before you ever enter any kind of a plea, then okay, you've pled guilty, whatever. But like the concept that saying, I didn't do it, I'm not guilty. That's just what happens. You stand up and you say, I've got the information. I waive the reading, not the rights, and they enter a plea of not guilty. And we'd like to set a date for a pretrial conference on this date. And that's just what happens. But
yeah, every movie you're definitely never going to see it in a military courtroom because of the amount of preparation it takes to plead guilty. I mean, you have to do a lot of preparation with your client to plead guilty.
And I really don't think that Kathy is like going to enter a plea of not guilty by going, yeah, they're not guilty. Okay, trial 3 weeks. A little nonchalant there, Dan. Sorry.
Yeah, especially for a military courtroom, but, you know, whatever. So
after they... I always think about this, too, by the way. After they enter the pleas, he enters the plea of not guilty, he says, so this is the inside of a courtroom. And all I think every time is like, oh, that's a civil lawyer right there. That's a civil lawyer.
But also, like, where were you doing your pleas?
Yeah, right.
Where were the pleas taking place? And in that vein, military courtrooms do not look like this. Civilian courtrooms, for the most part, do not look like this. I've done a trial in a Connex before. I've done a trial in a trailer before. They don't look like this. Nope. And also, our judges wear robes. This judge did not wear robes.
I wanted
robes
to ask about that. Did they just wear... Because the other question I wanted to ask was the jury... it's not 12 in the box. What's the number you get to? Like, how's that
work? To explain this to you would take at least another 2 hours. But it can be different numbers depending on the crime and, you know, whether it's a death case and, you know, all those sorts of things. And the level, there are different levels of court-martial. So depending on the level of court-martial, it's different. And then once you have that set, like this is the sentencing exposure for this person. Then during voir dire, there are kind of different, it has to be a certain, I don't know how to say it. There's a low threshold, but you can have up to a certain amount and below a certain amount. And if you get below a certain amount, you're going to bust the jury. You're going to have to get a new pool.
Okay.
It isn't set. It isn't like it's always 12. It can be 12. It can be 10. It can be 5. It can be 7.
Okay.
Even in the same level of exposure. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I was just curious. I mean, it makes sense to me that, again, the rules for juries don't have to match up with what the constitutional provision is in any particular state jurisdiction.
It used to be, like, in a general court-martial like this one, you had to hit an odd number that was not less than five. And it, you know, it kind of gets a little nutso. The lowest you were going to have is five. The most you're going to have is 12.
And it still blows my mind that you told me that you can't have mistrials. Like, they get ordered to make a decision. That's crazy to me.
Well, you don't. You can have mistrials. It's okay. Possible.
Oh, okay.
But also, okay. The jury can also be ordered to make a decision. Oh. I mean, I've had a jury before, like, come back and be like, we're never going to get a decision. And the judge has been like, you're going back in that room. And one of you is going to change your mind. And we'll be here a week. We'll be here a month. Whatever happens. We are going to finish this trial today.
We will have a unanimous decision.
Yeah, we will go all night. We're going to finish this trial. You're going to figure it out.
Yeah, see, that would be really good grounds for an appeal instead. Just excellent, excellent grounds for an appeal.
But we have mistrials in terms of, like, saying the wrong thing in front of the jury, like blurting something out that you shouldn't have, or, you know, that kind of thing. You get mistrial all the time. Hung juries do not have.
I guess hung jury was what I meant to say.
Yeah.
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 So
I guess it's possible. It's just I've never seen it happen.
Yeah. The other thing in the courtroom, just from the mechanics, was in JAG law, you guys set the defendant right next to the jury. You don't do the...
No. No, again, there's a lot of awkward courtrooms, so sometimes it happens. Like, the courtroom I practiced in most had, like, a weird L shape. We weren't next to each other. It was, like, because there just wasn't enough room in the courtroom for two tables.
Perfect.
So, the defense table actually faced the jury, and then the prosecution table faced the judge, if you can kind of, like, do that in your brain.
Yeah, we've done that.
Which
with,
is...
like...
real great, because I love the jury just being able to stare down my client the whole time for every little thing that every move, like, ooh, what does that mean? He's writing something down. It's like he's probably drawing, doodling, because he's bored at his own trial is what he's doing. But
we were in a big trial where we had a bunch of co-defendants, and so, you know, you got like six lawyers and two DAs and investigator, and we had to do the L-shaped thing, and we were always trying to put all the clients like next to each other. Usually you want to have like the client and their lawyer and the client and their lawyer and the client and their lawyer so they can talk and pass notes and like, oh, this didn't happen or whatever. But we were like, we do not want the jury just eyeing our guys the
entire it's awful.
Because and you have conversations, like I've had to have conversations with my client like, stop writing so many notes or stop looking so like,
oh yeah,
you know, there's a lot of performative aspects.
Do not show up tomorrow with a mustache. I swear to God, I will shave it myself if necessary.
I've told a client like, you need to grow out your hair. You just look menacing. And I'm sorry, we can't have that.
I'm sorry. So you just look, you don't look great.
You don't, you look grimy. And so I'm going to need you,
you
to
look grimy.
Bring it down.
In the military, you know, they really scrutinize the uniform too, like making sure all those medals are straight and in the right order and your name tape's straight and all, you're wearing all the stuff you're supposed to. Because you sit down, if you think about it, the jury can see exactly the kind of career that person has had, where they've been, what medals they've been awarded, have they been deployed, how many times, did they do well on that deployment, are they, you know, like, do they have a valor award, you know, like those sorts of things. They know immediately as soon as they sit down.
Yeah,
which is really interesting.
Yeah, the just the whole aspect of everybody being there under orders is something that I'm just never gonna understand. And having this thing where I know how long you've been in the military, like just by looking at Joe Galloway and looking at her rank, you're like probably seven eight years,
right?
You know, it's just those are things that do you tailor your arguments and things like that to an older jury, to a younger jury, to a, because you don't really, do you pick your jury? Do you go through that part of your process and select
the
jury?
The way it works is like there's a jury pool that's appointed by the convening authority. So the military trials are not prosecuted, like there's no prosecutorial discretion. The chain of command decides whether to prosecute the soldier. The chain
so
of command
Jessup
for that unit.
Who have been like,
so yeah, in this scenario, Colonel Jessup would have been the one that charged these two guys with these crimes, which would have been an improper referral and a conflict of interest and a whole bunch of stuff. But the general that's in charge of your base picks like 100 people. That's probably high, 50 people, you know, whatever it is,
right,
and says these people have what do you call it, secondary duty of being jurors for the next year. Every time there's a court martial, they're going to be the jury pool for a year. And then at the end of the year, they scrap them, they thank them all, and then they're done. So you're going to see the same jury pool over and over for every voir dire that you have for a year.
Okay.
And, you know, some people are just never going to serve on a jury because their brother's a cop, or they were a victim of a crime, or, you know, whatever, those things that normally get you kicked off a jury, but right. they have to show up for voir dire every time, and we wave at them. We're like, hey, you know, Colonel so-and-so, we'll ask you your question and then you can leave,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
But the thing is, you see the same 10 guys, 5 guys, 7 guys, whatever, over and over again. So if you have like a trick, if you're like a theatrical lawyer and you like to like do a little voir dire trick of like make an analogy about cookie crumbs or whatever, and then that like plants the seed of the reasonable doubt, or, you know, if you have like right. cutesy little stuff you do, you can't do that shit no. over and over and over again with these juries because they see through your
bullshit.
Facade.
Yeah.
So in terms of tailoring, yeah, you got to tailor it to a old Law and Order jury,
right.
mostly male. If you get like one lady on there, you're real lucky.
Yeah.
Male Law and Order, people that like short briefings and like to get out, you know, they don't like long-winded people, that's for sure.
Yeah, they want efficiency,
they're in the military.
And they want it in and out. And
they don't like to read, they joined the military. You know, like there are certain things, you might have some doctors or some engineers or some, you know, there's professionals that end up on the juries that are also in the military. But for the most part, you get people who raise their hand to be in the military. They're not, they don't like to sit around and be bored. That's
right.
why they chose kind of an action job, you know?
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, because, you know, for jury selection for us, it's, you know, for each particular crime, I have this sort of chart that I make out. You know, I don't have, it's not like I downloaded it, but I think about, okay, who would I want? Like, and unfortunately, you're doing certain stereotypes, or like, depending on who the victim is, depending on who the, you know, if I've got a 24-year-old kid who's just out of college, maybe I want somebody who's got a 24-year-old kid just out of college or something like that. That can, you know, think, oh, maybe I'd hate to see my son or my daughter, you know, be in this situation.
Right.
It doesn't sound like
And you're
like
not
that's
making decisions. You can't make decisions based on race or
right, of
gender
course.
Or,
of
you know, those
yeah,
sorts
yeah.
of things.
There's
We're talking about professions, backgrounds.
Exactly. Yeah. There are constitutional protections. You cannot do, like you said, protected classes and things like that to
right.
Excuse jurors. And there's actually just a new law that was passed in California that severely restricts the opportunities to do peremps. I will get into that into a separate episode because this is not California jurisdiction, so we're not going to do California.
Yeah, when I said you're lucky if you get a girl on the jury, I just meant that you don't have to talk to 10 guys all day. Like, it's just tend to have a friendlier face when you're a female attorney. That's all I meant by that.
So before we hop into opening statements, because I think once we get into the trial, this really kind of cooks and we can break down what we thought was good
yep.
and bad. But
yep.
I want to talk about trial preparation. That's my favorite part of this movie. That's what I think, you know, when I'm thinking back on what they get really, really, really right in this movie, it's the all-encompassing nature of trial preparation. You're wearing sweatpants all the time. You're, you know, a lot of takeout. Big board, sticky notes everywhere, ideas,
yeah.
bad ideas, a whole bunch of bad ideas that you write up on the board and then get rid of, notes everywhere. You start doing research that... you know isn't going to go anywhere, but you're like, maybe I'll find that case that has never
like,
existed ever.
Maybe there's a case that says.
You know? Do you get this? Like, every now and again, I try... Actually, I do this all the time. I always love citing cases from the 1800s. I just think it's funny. Like, to have a brief and have
You've
one case where
this.
You're like, 1896.
No, I don't find that fun. I don't understand why you do it.
I love it. And I think I love it because I got a judge that gave me shit over a case that was perfectly good law. It wasn't, I mean, I'm going to use...
From 1895.
Just for you guys out there, when you're researching a case, you basically have green, yellow, and red. Red means this isn't good law anymore. Yellow means it's probably good, but there might be some parts that have been distinguished or whatever.
Parts of it maybe aren't good anymore.
And then red usually is like you don't use a red case. Like you just, a
yeah,
red
you can't
case
use
is...
red case.
Or I'm sorry, a green, I think I was going the other way. A green case, you're good to go. Everything's fine.
Yeah.
So this was green all day long because it was very simple law that had never, like, nobody would challenge this. But it was a Supreme Court case from like 1975. And the judge goes, I don't know, counsel, this is a pretty old case. Do you have anything newer? No, this.
But that's because that judge didn't want to look it up and see if it was green or not. What that judge wanted was for you to cite a 2020 case that
right.
you didn't have to Google. That's what it was.
And all I'm like, and it was such a simple, like, the law that we were talking about was that you don't have to invite the police into your house. and not inviting the police into your house is not resisting arrest. Like, this is blanket, very easy stuff. Little tip out there, guys, even if they have a warrant, you don't have to make them a cup of coffee. That doesn't mean they can't break your door down. They may legally be able to do that, but as long as you don't affirmatively lock it, you don't do anything to block their way, they can't arrest you for resisting arrest. And that is a very clear law, at least it is in California and everywhere else I've ever seen it. And this judge was like, I don't know, anything newer? So now I just am in love with, like, no, this is from 1897. Still good. You can look it up. It's fine. But that trial preparation just, I loved it. It's very accurate in this movie where you just get people throwing everything at the board, brainstorming sessions. Here's the plan. Let's stick to the plan. What goes in these boxes? It's just perfect. Like, I don't know of a movie that would do that better. It's just as correct as far as I'm concerned.
It was very good.
And then we get to court and they're ready to do opening statements. And I'm shocked at how good I think these opening statements are.
They're fine.
I find in movies and TV, opening statements are usually arguments. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, and you can't do that in real life.
Yeah.
You get away with a little of it, but not a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you can try to sneak in an argument from time to time, but for the most part, exactly what Jack Ross did is an opening statement. Here's what the charges are, here's who's been charged with them, here's what happened, and here's what the evidence is going to show. That's it. You don't apply any of the testimony to what you think happened. And for the most part, what Kathy said is also perfectly acceptable. Maybe a little nonchalant with the just ain't true. Probably not going to say it that way, but I don't know. you're such a liar.
No, I'm not. I'm not.
You tell me you've done that.
One of my very favorite trial partners is a guy from West Virginia that had the folksiest accent. The military juries just eat that shit up, though, like a folksy accent and that kind of thing. And he had an expert where the expert said something about their curriculum vitae, which is what you submit to the court and mark as the expert. And he's like, curriculum vitae. Now, if I'm not mistaken, is that a fancy word for resume? It's like, oh, my God. Like, I literally had to hang my head so that the jury wouldn't see me laughing. It's like he just, like, the charisma of that. You know, if you can pull it off, if you can pull it off, just ain't true, you should do it.
Yeah, well, and Tom Cruise does, but you got to do it.
Wait, are you saying that I don't have folksy charisma?
I think I was saying that I don't have folksy charisma.
Oh, okay,
good. This is from somebody who told me her beach view slaps today, which we'll talk about that later.
I said that it slapped different than your beach view, and I was just trying to say it in words that a Los Angeles Hollywood lawyer would understand.
That is how we talk. Okay. Your Honor, this motion slaps. You're going to love this. So the opening statements were great. And then we get to witness testimony. And there's a bunch of objections they could have hit. But I'm not mad that they didn't hit them.
I'm not mad at it.
They go quick. Yeah, I'm not mad at it. Because objections just slow your movie down unless it is a meaty, plot-driven objection. By the way, I let some objections go. Like, if I don't give a shit and it's not hurting me. And, you know, there's some lawyers out there. I'm sorry. I could object every question. They're just bad questions. They're asking objectionable questions all day long. And you're like, I can't keep objecting to this.
But sometimes the line of questioning is great for you. Like, sometimes you're not objecting because you're like, oh my God, like how are they digging this hole? This is insane.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like they're literally feeding you Twinkies at dinner. You're like, I know I'm not supposed to have this for dinner, but I will eat it. I love it. Yep. Do you guys do speaking objections?
In terms of standing up and saying, I have an objection?
No, in terms of like when Jack Ross stands up and says, objection, Your Honor, does the prosecutor really expect this witness to testify to what all these other people, you know, whatever. And it's no, the objection is objection speculation. So we
it kind of just depends on the judge. Some judges are strict enough that you stand up and you say objection and then you wait for them to ask you the basis and they get mad if you say the basis first. Some will, like, if you say, are we gonna have the whole platoon come in here, and they'll be like, whoa, what are you trying to say? Is it cumulative? You know, it's like, obviously that's what I'm saying. So it just depends on the judge.
We have, like, for the most part, I've never seen a judge that, like, if you have hearsay, you don't state the basis for why it's hearsay. You just say objection, hearsay. And then if he overrules it and you object again, you could say, hey, you know, I need to be heard. And you can go up to the bench or you can go in the back and say, this is the Because they don't want you making an argument in front of the jury as to why they should disregard the evidence.
Yeah.
But again, I know judges, or I've heard of judges in other states that are totally cool with that. I had a stipulation question for you real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys do oral stipulations?
Depends.
Okay. Can. Yeah, usually yeah. For us, we still have to write them out and then they sort of get read to the jury. But, you know.
Very rarely. I think okay. I would say 90% are written.
Okay. We got to get to strenuous objections. Let's dive into this. This is not great.
So, this is the doctor. This is some of the worst lawyering. The worst lawyering we've seen Joe Galloway do up until now is interfering with a federal investigation and then a trial and then the lunch at Cuba.
This was abysmal, really bad.
Yeah. This is worse.
Yes.
So a doctor is testifying about some medical stuff in terms of like how this kid died, and she objects because she doesn't want him to testify to various medical conclusions that he's made. The judge overrules her. You got to be really careful when you object to a witness providing additional information to the jury, because juries want additional information. And if they start seeing, they want to hear the evidence, whatever it is, they feel like they're smart enough to decide whether or not the evidence is good evidence or not. And so when you're the person standing up being like, no, don't let them hear this, they start to think, oh, well, that sounds like that's the silver bullet that's going to convict your guy. We want to hear it. Especially if it's not that big of a deal, you don't want, because what they're imagining that evidence is far worse for your guy than probably what it actually is.
Right. And they're going to, even if you lose the objection like they do here, they're going to assign it so much more weight because
right.
you just
yeah.
threw a shit fit over right. trying to keep it out.
So you got to, if you want something to be kept out and you're going to stand up and object in front of the jury, it better be really sure that you want to yeah. do that. And she does it, and then she's overruled, and then the jury hears, no, she's overruled, and then she immediately stands up again and says she strenuously objects. And I don't know if you notice this, it's not even her fucking witness.
Nope.
It's Kathy's witness.
It's Kathy's
so
witness.
So she's tag-teaming, standing up, it's his witness, and she's fucking him up. He needs to be the
yep.
one objecting.
And he did
she
a good
asked
cross,
for an emergency.
By the way. That was a good cross.
Like, great cross.
Yeah.
Kathy's great in court.
Kathy's a very good trial lawyer. I think he's yes. shitty at research and bad at doing the behind the scenes stuff, but he's showtime.
Which is great for a guy who pleads out everything.
Right.
So she then asks for an emergency 39A session, which basically is a motions hearing. That means she wants the jury gone to argue this, which is ridiculous because she's already lost the jury. We may as well go ahead and have this out in the open now that they hate you and think that you're trying to hide things from them.
Right.
The judge denies it. She just throws a shit fit.
Yeah. Well,
a tantrum.
She then says, like, the strenuous objection is really dumb.
Strenuous objection is another thing that never stops happening.
Nor should it.
Court.
She's
like,
earned that
oh,
one.
did you strenuously object, though? Because that might have helped you.
But then she's like, move to reconsider. That's the dumbest thing yeah. I've ever heard in my life.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's a kid like asking to spend the night for the fourth time when the parents have been like, they're at the point where they're saying, I'm going to give you up like for adoption. You're pissing me
right.
off so much. No, but, mm-hmm. but what about now? Like, no, it's crazy. And again, Kathy, the way this was written, it was a very good cross. There was a lot of testifying by Kathy in the cross, which... Mm-hmm. Again, is a narrative device that don't do that. If you want to go practice law, you don't get to testify in your questions. You can be sly about it and you can do it a little bit, but you can't give a 4-sentence question.
Right.
And then you did this and then you did this and then you did this and then you did this. Didn't you? Like,
that's a little
not great, but it was like Kathy did what he was supposed to do, tore him down. But then was that not the easiest rehabilitation you've ever seen from a prosecutor?
Yeah.
Aren't
I mean,
you the
oh,
most
God.
Qualified person in the history of the world in this particular area of medicine? Yes.
Yeah.
All right, then.
Okay. Well, let's hear what he has to say, then. Yeah. Oh, she looked like such an idiot.
And Weinberg had every right to light her the hell up.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
The judge should have lit her the hell up. I don't know about, like, in the military, the judge would have told her to sit down the second time. The judge wouldn't have allowed her to object in the first place, tag-teaming a witness like that.
Yeah, I could have seen a judge saying, let's come into chambers. We need to talk.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
sure.
calling a recess and having all the attorneys go back into chambers and being like, look, this is not how we do this in my courtroom. This is not how we object. You can object once I give you my ruling. You've made your record. Mm-hmm. Moving on. Like, yep. Don't ever do that again. So we touched on it a little earlier. Let's talk very briefly about how bad of a lawyer you got to be to spend 8 weeks on a drunken disorderly. How much of a waste resources is that?
Huge.
Yeah.
Just the courtroom alone.
Yeah. It's just not, it's for her to, be bragging about that. And for like Kathy to be like, oh my God, you really waxed his ass. No lawyer would be impressed by that. That's not an impressive story. You're a bad lawyer who did bad work. That would have been a mistrial. The judge would have just ended the trial. You would have been fired rightfully. That's just not, it's just not good.
And somewhere a prosecutor is telling an impressive story, a hilariously impressive story about how they got strung into an 8 week drunken disorderly trial.
And how they're like, yeah. And the best part was her client was in custody. So instead of taking the 15 days that I offered, the guy actually was in custody for 72 days because of this trial. So I just kept letting it go.
We offered to dismiss the case. She said she wanted to do an 8 week trial.
That's bullshit.
Yeah.
So the defense case they put on Noah Wiley, I thought they did a great job. That redirect on Ross with the book, that's great courtroom
work. That's the best stuff there, yeah.
I've seen something very similar to that happen. A trial partner of mine did that with a doctor who was just being a jerk. You have jerk witnesses, and it was really weird to see this doctor who was put on by the prosecution to just basically say, yes, I was the doctor who took in this victim, and this is what the diagnosis was, and this was the surgery we had to do.
Mm-hmm.
He was an asshole to her when she was like, could you tell us a little bit about your education? Where'd you go to college? A university in California. Okay, what university was that? Well, it was University of this and this. And what did you do after that? Well, I went to grad school. It was just that sort of like, okay, dude. Mm-hmm. And she put down all these medical records in front of him that were the victim's entire medical records. Was like, did you review these before you came to court today? Yes. Okay. And then asked him some questions. Gets up across, my trial partner goes up and goes, you looked at all those, right? Yes. Okay, I'd like to mark these as defense exhibit such and such and admit those in. Because they were records that we couldn't get through a subpoena. They had been blocked, but she just set them up there. Ugh. And it was so good. It was so great. So stuff like that happens. Like, I love it. It was not Hollywood trickery. Sometimes that happens. And if you have a lawyer who is sharp enough to do that, it's incredible to watch. It's really, really incredible to watch.
Yeah, it was great.
Why is the defense calling the Apostle John Kendrick?
I don't know. I guess because they weren't going to call him because he made the order or maybe the prosecution was scared of him. But this establishes the illegal orders issue, basically. That, I mean, they didn't do themselves any favors by showing that their guy was aware that this is an illegal order and that code reds are not legal. I mean, the defense really tripped and fell on this witness.
Yes.
And I don't think they know it. Like, I think Weinberg knows it. I don't think Galway and Caffey know it.
No, and this is where I sort of keep leaning on Weinberg as, like, he's the backbone of this defense team. Is he's got Joe, who loves paperwork, and he's good at research, and he's good at preparing witnesses, and he's got this, like, stud that knows how to shine, but, like, you gotta rein that shit in, and you're gonna miss some stuff because you're trying to go so fast, or you're trying to be your dad, or whatever it is. And Weinberg kind of keeps the whole shit together. But we haven't even brought up his name, but I guess we would be doing a disservice if you didn't tell us why Markinson, by disappearing and going AWOL, wouldn't get a hotel and a steak.
Yeah, Markinson, who's the defense key witness, Colonel, Major, Lieutenant Colonel? I don't know what he is. Commander Markinson?
Let's call Lieutenant, Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Andrew Markinson.
He's a Marine, right?
I've got Lieutenant Colonel on my notes, so I've got
Lieutenant Colonel. So he's probably Jessup's deputy. He's the one that wanted to transfer Santiago out, and Jessup said no, which, I mean, to be completely honest with you, was the right call. Team Jessup.
All day. I get it.
He goes AWOL because he... I don't really understand. I guess he thinks he's going to be implicated in this thing.
Yeah, so he goes AWOL. He tries to take a moral stand by running away and not taking it up the chain of command, which I guess would be Jessup, but...
Yeah, I mean, he has no code or honor.
Right.
Goes AWOL, and then they find him. No, he climbs into the back of Kathy's car.
He actually had just been in Kathy's trunk.
Yeah, and spooks just the
slipped
hell
into
out of
the
him.
Back seat.
Yeah. So what happens when you've gone AWOL and you return? For the most part, they throw you in jail immediately because it's a flight risk case that kind of establishes itself.
Right.
There's no way, in this case, they're kind of keeping him a secret by putting him in a hotel and just ordering marshals to guard him. I don't know where they get to order marshals to do it. I've never been able to order a U.S. marshal to do anything.
Where you're like, hey, I have this criminal that you guys can prosecute later, but I need you to hold them in the motel over by the Waffle House.
Well,
I just don't
I
get
mean,
that.
Marshals are, so if a witness doesn't show up to a military court-martial,
right,
or we need to go find somebody or somebody's AWOL or whatever, they're the ones that go find our guys.
Oh, sure, that I understand.
But no, we're not going to put them in a hotel room guarded by marshals. And for this is true in every criminal case, but especially in the military, you have witness lists ahead of time. There's no such thing as a surprise witness. You don't get to surprise anybody with a witness. Everybody
right.
gets the list ahead of time. Everybody gets the opportunity to interview everybody ahead of time. You shouldn't be asking any questions at court you don't already know the answer to. It happens, but it's a violation of the rules to call a surprise witness, right?
Right. Well, and for the most part, this is something we see all the time, but there's really no surprises, particularly by the prosecution. The defense,
right.
and it's literally the only thing that is sort of in favor of the defense. The book is unfairly, in a lot of ways, stacked in favor of the prosecution. But we can have what's called impeachment evidence. So, like, I can have some evidence that I don't have to turn over to the prosecutor because the only way I get to use it is if their witness lies and I can prove the lie. So
right.
I don't have to provide that to them.
Sure.
But
this guy isn't impeachment evidence.
This is not impeachment evidence. And this is, as you were saying, you have a witness list. And when you put a witness list together, you're not putting a list that says, these are all the people I'm going to call. It's these are all the people I could possibly call. So
right.
I've had trials where we've called no witnesses, but I have 31 names on my witness list, just in case.
Yes. And in the military, the defense provides the witness list, even the impeachment witnesses, to the prosecution ahead of time. And then they have to justify to the prosecution because the unit pays for the trial. So if you're flying people in, you have to justify why the unit's paying for it. So the defense has to not only give them a witness list, but a narrative of what they're going to testify to show them that it's relevant. So they're not just like bogging down the unit and making the prosecutor run around, because the prosecution has to find the witnesses and transport them to the trial for the defense, which is very different from the civilian world.
Yes.
So there's no way they could have this like secret witness. Like they're complicit in his AWOL.
Yes.
At some point by just putting him in a hotel.
Put him, like, if I'm them, I don't want a security detail. Put him in jail, and guess what he can do? Be brought out to testify.
You know what else he can't do if he's in pretrial confinement? Fucking shoot himself
shoot
in the
himself.
Head, which is
shoot
what
himself
happened.
In the fucking face. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be harder.
So they could have saved a life by throwing this guy in jail.
So basically,
and what would they have lost except for that Kevin Bacon would have been able to go interview him? He may have dismissed the case. Who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, it may have been better for their guy.
Yeah. It is just like very peculiar, dramatic, but let's just say that's not how that works.
Yeah, anyway, he kills himself and he doesn't get to testify, which puts them in a spot. They go and find the flight crew on the flight that didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah. You guys have a rule on witnesses, right? In
military
court.
They don't get to sit in the courtroom and watch the trial. No.
Yeah, that's a big one.
To intimidate the witness into telling the truth.
There's a bunch of witnesses watching testimony. That's not a thing. Real important that witnesses don't watch the testimony of other witnesses.
Nope. The only witnesses that get to watch the testimony are your client.
Yep.
In some military trials, you're paralegal if you need to bring them up for impeachment evidence.
Yep.
And in military trials, the victim.
Okay. We can have, the prosecution can have a dedicated investigator for the trial. So that investigator, who maybe is usually a detective in the case, will be able to watch the whole case and then still give their testimony. But yeah, the defendant, pretty much it. You don't get to just sit there and have friend after friend watch how their buddies testified. And then, like, one of the first questions you ask every witness is, have you talked to anybody about this case since the trial started?
Yep.
And if they say yes, oh, really? Who is that? Well, I talked to the prosecutor. Oh, really? Which I'll talk about. You know, that's a that can become a fertile ground where you just see the prosecutor going,
no,
because we'll make a meal out of a scheduling meeting. I just want you to know that.
Sure.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't receive an email about that judge.
No one told me about that meeting.
I didn't get a report. Yeah. Huh. So then they decide to bring in Jessup.
Wait, no, I'm sorry. I need to talk about the... the clients testify before Jessup, right?
Oh, yeah, we got to do that. I'm sorry. Yeah, we got to do that.
Just really quick. I know we're 2 hours into this.
Hey, who cares? It's for us.
You're right. This is for... No one's going to listen to this. Humvees don't get flat tires. So, A, the idea that they don't know that one of their clients wasn't actually at the battalion meeting where this was ordered is insane.
Now, this is Downey's testimony, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, another hard fail by Joe and Weinberg. Yeah. This is a Weinberg problem, too, because he was in there on the prep.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that they're finding this out at trial, that one of their clients ordered the other one to do this code red, is crazy bad preparation. But also this Humvee situation, I don't know if he's lying on the stand. I don't know if Joe knows that Humvees can't get flat tires. I have no idea. I don't know if this is a writing error or something that we're supposed to like discern something from, but, that the pickup private or whatever, he didn't get a flat tire. That's not how that works.
Well, and the witness preparation, like, you go through your witness, like, the prep is very strenuous, and you never, like, I don't engage in the business of telling them what to say, but there is, my investigator will go through that with them and prep them, and I, you know, I'll provide, like, these are the areas of inquiry, we need to know what happened, you know, when you're talking about your client, and you go through it with them, and I ask my clients multiple times throughout the course of representation the same questions, because I want to make sure it all lines up. I want to make sure.
Yeah, you
want to
make sure you're getting the same answer every time.
Yeah, I need to make sure they don't change shit. So, that was spectacularly bad lawyering.
Yes.
Which is weird to say because I think on the whole, the portrayal of lawyering in this movie is actually fairly solid.
Oh yeah.
Now we get to Jessup, and they say, "Well, okay, we're going to call Jessup. Let's just make him. We'll just get it out of him."
Or don't. They say if you don't think you're going to get it out of him, you need to sit down because accusing him of a crime could like implicate somehow Caffey in a crime, which is not a thing. This thing that they're talking about is not a thing. In fact, if you don't zealously represent your client to the ends of the earth, that's a crime.
The fear they have is unfounded because they have reason to believe that the person they are calling to the stand has done the thing. So there's no way that they could be considered breaking any kind of code of ethics or anything else. And if Joanne Galloway thinks that I'm internal affairs, I can tell you can get in a lot of trouble. Joe, I don't believe anything you're saying.
Believe any laws you talk about anymore.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if he's not going to get it, he should sit down because the jury has a lot of respect for this guy who has a bird on his chest. So, you know, like, let's cool it if it's not going our way. So I agree with the advice. I don't agree with the reason.
Words right out of my mouth. Like, you don't lob unfounded or ridiculous accusations, but it's also not a crime to do that. So we haven't talked a ton. We've just been sort of lobbing random praise on Daniel Caffey for the most part about his performance in court, and he's very good in court. This is what happens when, like, you do have Tom Cruise lawyers that are just charismatic as hell in court. They just are, and it doesn't have anything to do with looks or anything like that. It's just some people are innately comfortable in that performative aspect, and it is a performance.
People like us, you know?
Yeah, right? I mean, like, usually it's like people who, like, start podcasts and just want to talk about it. That's typically... Yeah. Where you get your all-stars.
The kind of people that are so charismatic in court.
But can I just tell you that he calls Jessup to the stand, and most of his examinations had been pretty good.
Yeah.
And then this is the Jeremy Renner Jeep commercial of examinations. This is so bad. This is not examining. This is so terrible. This is testifying. All Tom Cruise is doing in this entire thing is testifying for Colonel Jessup about what Colonel Jessup has done. He's testifying about, like, even when he brings up, he's like, in Santiago's room, there was this and this and this and this and this was left in there. I don't know that.
Okay. I haven't been in Santiago's room.
How would I know that? And by the way, you would have Jack Ross jump up and going, "Objection, Your Honor, total lack of foundation. There's nothing here that means that this witness could testify to any of the shit that he's being asked."
Yeah.
The one procedural thing I wanted to ask you, do you guys get depositions?
No.
Or do they just, okay. Because he does say, we'd like a little latitude because we didn't get to depose the witness. In California, criminal defendant, we don't get to have depositions. That's not a thing.
I mean, if you didn't get to interview the witness, you could get some latitude.
Right, but, right.
Yeah.
So it's just terrible. It's very dramatic.
But they did. We were there. And it so was bad. A terrible interview.
And Jessup, I was giving a lot of credit for being smart. As a witness, if someone says you don't have to answer that.
Don't.
You just don't answer it. You actually aren't allowed to. It invalidates the question. And Jack Ross, who I thought had been a good lawyer through this whole thing too. Everybody fell asleep during Jessup. Because Jack mm-hmm. Ross should be jumping on the fucking table screaming. Objection,
mm-hmm.
objection, objection. No yeah. question pending. I'm going to ask the witness to be
mistrial,
quiet.
Mistrial.
Yeah.
Like.
This is bad. This is bad. Mm-hmm. So it's weird because it is a wonderful scene and I love it. And I'm pretty sure both of us have it memorized. But it's just the worst lawyering. But at the end of the day, he gets him to admit to the crime, which is rare. I've not seen that before.
Kind of. I mean, he kind of gets him to admit the crime. He admits to giving the order. I mean, Jessup giving the order and these guys following the order are two separate crimes. Like, I don't think that Jessup admitting to have given the order for the Code Red really helps these guys all that much.
I mean, there's got to be completely a conspiracy honest. Element to it, right? Like, that's conspiracy to commit?
Sure. I mean, Jessup committed a crime. I think it implicates him in the murder. I think he's given an illegal order. Like, I think there are a litany of crimes. He's given false official statements. He's doctored documents. He's done a lot of shit here.
Right.
He's obstruction of justice, definitely. But I don't think that helps these two guys get a not guilty for murder because it's an illegal order.
I think it totally helps them get the NG in civilian court. I don't think it does in military court. Because I think there have been cases I've seen where you can just say, oh, somebody else did something really bad. So, you know what? Especially in co-defendant cases.
Yeah, I mean, the jury might go that way because of that. I'm just saying, like, it's not the right answer, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, by the law, they're still guilty of the shit they did. It's not a defense.
By the law, it doesn't help their client.
Right.
This jury might hate Jessup enough that they find him not guilty of the murder, which is what happened.
Right.
But it doesn't help that the clients have already shown that they know that this was an illegal order and that they did it.
Yes. This is the hard part where you have clients all the time. And this isn't a client problem. This is their defense. That's what it is to say, hey, this guy's worse than me. I was ordered to do this. And that's what they have. Sometimes you have shit defense. And while it's shit defense, it's a defense. But you have to a certain degree, explain to clients sometimes what you're saying is not a defense to the crime. Like, I have clients all the time that go, why'd they get me? I know five other guys that do the same thing. They didn't arrest them. Not a defense to the crime. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
You knowing other criminals does not exonerate the crime you're committing. It's not how it works. So it's weird to me, though, that Ross, I guess it's probably right. I mean, I don't disagree with him not dismissing the case.
No, I wouldn't have dismissed the case. I don't disagree with the 2-year manslaughter plea, but I'm not dismissing the case.
Right.
Sorry.
Do you guys engage in plea discussions during trials ever?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, so that I didn't know if they just shut that down and that
we've,
didn't
happen. We've stopped the trial to plead guilty before.
Where you might go outside and be like, hey, you know, if I'm Jack, go, hey, I'll give you the 2 years on the murder. Now, I'm not saying they would have taken it, but, you know.
Yeah, we've, you know, sometimes things happen during trial that really change the trajectory.
Of course.
Like Markinson or whatever would have maybe changed the trajectory of this. But then, you know, Jessup admits to this, goes a little nuts, says some stuff that, you know, isn't that bad, but does
not
say
terrible.
Some stuff that is pretty bad.
Colorful.
I'm a little team Jessup in this speech.
I think you're team Jessup in 97% of this movie.
I don't agree with a Code Red. The thing is, you can't just transfer Santiago because he's not doing well as a Marine. You got to train the, you got to make him, you got to be a leader.
You got to train the lad. I know, Aaron. I understand. Yeah,
but not by hazing him, but additional leadership. No, there's no good. No, I don't want to code anything. I'm just saying, you know, maybe he needs some additional PT. Maybe he needs some mentorship. Maybe get him a mentor. that kind of thing. You don't just transfer him out so he becomes somebody else's problem. That's bad.
No, I agree that that's good leadership to keep him there, but not to Jessup him.
No, don't Jessup him. And, you know, for some of that speech, the, you know, like, you want to question how I do things, and but you're not there and you don't know what the reality of this situation is. I feel that sometimes. I feel like the military feels that a lot of the time. But, you know, the rest of the stuff, which is like, you know, I'm going to drink out of your skull and, you know, that stuff.
Shit down your neck and piss in your dead skull. Yeah, not great.
Yeah, no, not great.
I am still waiting, though, for the time in my life when I can look at somebody and say, listen, you rise and fall under the blanket of the very freedom that I provide and then question the manner in which I provide it. I would rather you just said thank you and went on your way. I haven't run into that yet, but I'm working on
it. Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to say I'm like pro anything specific. I just feel like that's a sentiment that is felt in the military a lot of the time.
And I thoroughly respect that you think Jessup is the hero. Of a few good
no,
men.
I do Very not. Peculiar. I do not condone
That's okay.
hazing.
That's all
I
right.
Do not.
No, it's fine.
I do not.
Hashtag Santiago got what he deserved. That's cool. so that's kind of all the law that we. I mean, I know it's a lot, and this episode is obviously thick because this hits so much military stuff and so much law that we, you know, a little long in the tooth with this one, guys. But hey, guess what? That's what we're here for. We're here to give you everything, not some of it, the whole pie. Before
Honestly, there's more
go,
we could have talked about.
Before we let you go, we have some awards to give out.
Yes.
So I want to go to you for our most right award. What do you have
like
for the
most authentic to my military or legal experience?
Yeah, like what did you look at this and go, man, they really nailed the shit out of that.
Yeah, you know, I don't think it's to this extreme, but that chasm between the military lawyer and the client due to just rank and like the type of military that you see day to day, I think was really, really hit home for me. They don't want to talk to you. It's one word answers. It's a lot of, you know, sitting and standing and attention. It takes a lot for them to warm up to you.
I picked the trial prep / Yoo-hoo consumption. Yeah. I think those are the most.
Yeah, I don't know that that's a universal thing,
hey,
the Yoo-hoo.
This is my truth. I'm just saying, you want to be a great lawyer, Yoo-hoo the shit out of your prep, okay?
All right. The most unrealistic thing?
Man, I think I got to go Aunt Jenny. Just the whole Aunt Jenny thing.
Yeah.
I think for me is it.
It's pretty bad. For me, it was moving the entire court-martial to D.C. and then flying up every single participant except for two lawyers.
Yes.
that was the thing that I just couldn't believe.
Speaking of sending the lawyers, who's your best lawyer in this whole deal?
Caffey.
Okay, I've got Weinberg. I think all around Weinberg's it. I think Caffey's the only one who could have won the trial.
Yeah, I think this case could have been won by Caffey without Weinberg. Could have been. But I do not think Weinberg could have won this case without Caffey.
No, absolutely. I agree with you. I agree with that. I just think if I'm gauging all the skills, you know, research, writing, preparation, trial, whatever, he just checks a few more than me. But I think we can both agree that the worst lawyer...
Joe Ann Galloway,
Lieutenant, former Lieutenant Commander, dishonorably discharged from the Navy, Joanne Galloway.
And you know what? Honorable mention, Jack Ross did a great job, too.
Jack Ross did do a good job. I had no problem with Jack Ross.
But as far as, like, our home team, it's just that Joe was bad, really.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, obviously, we've been kind of picking apart what's been bad, but like we said a little earlier, this is a surprisingly good legal movie, particularly setting it in a... I'm going to say foreign jurisdiction, not, you know, from geography, but just like,
and all the terminology is right. You know, like they really do a lot of good.
You don't really have to because most people are not going to know that stuff.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, it's impressive that they did that. I would like to know what you think is the most unethical either part or lawyer in the movie.
It is Joe Galloway speaking to Caffey's client over and over and over again, following him around and then speaking to his family members in order to backdoor herself into the case.
Yeah, I agree with you, but in an effort to not be like, Aaron, you're right. I agree with you on all of these. I'm going to go with Private Yardarm Esquire that wanted to send the guy to like Fort Leavenworth for
selling
a dime bag of oregano. That is prosecutorial misconduct, and it is unappreciated by this defense attorney.
And also, hiding a high-risk soldier who just came back from AWOL in a hotel room is not only a huge risk for the military that he's going to run again, but also a huge risk to that soldier, and it resulted in his death. So you want to talk about murders. Put it out there.
It's not just Jessup, guys. We get it, Aaron. It's not just Jessup.
We talk about unethical things, we're just talking about the lawyers. Obviously, the worst thing in this movie was how they did kill that kid with that hazing.
That was bad. Yep.
Yeah, but the lawyers didn't do that.
Yeah, we're talking, again, this is a law podcast. So we're focusing on that. Also, I think probably honorable mention for Tom Cruise telling Joanne Galloway that he's seriously aroused by her.
Yeah,
not great.
Another little nugget that just never goes away.
Never going to go away.
When you argue with people about legal things, that's a great way to just shut down a female attorney. So I guess that's it. I guess we're done. There's more stuff we could have talked about, but I think after 2 hours and whatever, we need to go. So we're going to do this, I think, monthly, maybe a little less. Listen, we've got day jobs, obviously. We've got other podcasts, obviously. We're going to do this as much as we can, but we're thinking monthly or so.
Yes, I think that's a fair goalpost for us. So, guys, don't forget, follow us at Movie Briefs Pod on Instagram and Twitter. You can email us at moviebriefspod@gmail.com. Subscribe, rate, review on all the podcast apps and everything like that. You know, we're around. We can't wait to interact with you guys and answer all your questions. Give us your movie ideas, whatever. And, you know, we're really excited about this. I think this is going to be a ton of fun.
So next up, we're going to go back to law school and do Legally Blonde. So if you have questions or comments about Legally Blonde that you want us to talk about, please send them in to those places. I guess until next time, we're in recess.
See you guys.
Bye.